Even Monday night's primetime programming on the USA Network had become formulaic. Even Monday night's primetime programming on the USA Network had become formulaic. Monday night's primetime programming on the USA Network. Formulaic. Formulaic. Formulaic.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Who's that? You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 336 of The Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 13, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. Boy, Monday night's programming in primetime being formulaic? I can't imagine. I can't imagine such a thing. And that was a clip, for those of you who missed it, and apparently many of you did, of the debut episode of the Monday Night War on the WWE Network this past Monday night. They have their free week preview for people trying to bring in subscribers, so they aired the very first episode. The actual show is not going to start airing until next month. So a lot of the people who missed it when it aired after Raw Monday night were very pissed off because they thought it would be on demand, and in fact it is not on demand and probably won't be until it starts airing in August. But I caught it. I actually thought it was a pretty good show, but when I got to that part when they had the voiceover guy talking about what he was really talking about was primetime wrestling, the old WWF show used to air on Monday nights, and it used to be this formula of, you know, whether it was Monsoon and Heenan or a round table panel they had later on, they would throw it to pre-recorded matches from house shows, and they would throw it to matches that were taped during Superstars tapings and Challenge tapings, and it was, you know, pretty much the same stuff every single week. And they were talking about how formulaic the show was, but I couldn't help but laugh when I heard that, because you could say the same thing about Raw these days. How formulaic the show is every single week. You could call it almost right down to the nanosecond. Who's going to open the show? Who's going to come out next? They're going to put the same set of graphics up, and you know they're going to put the same, you know, the dead match is going to go in this time period, and everything. Everything about that show, the look, you know, the sameness of it. I just don't know how smart it is to be putting a show on the network that talks about how formulaic programming on Monday nights used to be, because it's just as formulaic today. The PayPal shout-outs for this week, want to mention them up front here, people who have donated to the show on thesolidmonster.com. Again, you can donate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just log on and give what you want, give what you can. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. We have Trevon Cannonball Clark, Commander Thomas Johnson, Blue Steel Christopher Osborne, Graham GSM Matthews, Jersey Boy James Cecere, The All Night Player Aniket Sawant, Exotic Emmanuel Mabadije, Masterpiece Matthew Barnes, Air Assault Chris James, and Playboy Tiago Lorero. So thank you to everybody who donated, and there were a lot of you this week. Very much appreciated. If I could just go back to the network for a second. Yeah, I was talking about the Monday Night War. I thought, overall, it was an hour long. I thought the show was really good. It's still a WWE-produced production, so you're going to get their side of the story. There's going to be a little bit of bias there. I thought, overall, though, they kept it pretty even-keeled. And I think when the series debuts, that's going to be one of the ones to really watch and make time for, I think, because it'll take you back to a fun period in wrestling history, and hopefully we'll get some new, fresh feedback from people that they've interviewed. It was very interesting seeing some of the talking heads who popped up on the special, including Vince Russo, who I guess they had back in studio some time ago to tape some comments. So that was unexpected, seeing him pop up on my television screen, or my computer screen. Actually, no, it was my television screen. I watched it on the Roku, no problems. But I want to talk about the network here because there's been a lot of network talk lately. They have this free trial period now. They're trying to lure in new subscribers. July 31st is the day that they're having their next investors call. That's when they're going to announce the new updated number of network subscribers. And it's going to be a big day. It may not be a good day for WWE. The last number they announced was 667,000. That was the day after WrestleMania when they announced that number. Some people thinking that perhaps the number could be even lower than that. If I had to predict, my prediction would be that that number is going to end up somewhere between 750 and 800,000 which would not be good, especially if their goal was to hit a million by the end of the year. But we'll see. That's just my prediction wasn't really too far off the first time. I think I predicted like around 650, so I wasn't too far off. There's always a chance the number could go down, but I know there's a lot of people out there very upset with the content being offered, the content not being offered, but I'm going to predict between 750 and 800. But the point is, they're going all in on this network. They have to make this work, because if this network is a bust, it's going to be a huge blow to the company, and we're already seeing it with all the cost-cutting that's going on, the people that have lost their jobs. It's all because of the network. It all goes back to the network. And when I look at what's being offered on the network, there's a lot of good stuff on there. You know, they're trying to keep the Raw library updated. I think they're up to 1995 now, and they're updating a new episode, I think every week. I could be wrong. I think it's every week. They just updated part of their Saturday night's main event library. I would guess they're waiting to upload the remaining years, because right now it's only up to 1987. They don't have any of the main event specials, but the main event specials didn't come, I think, until 88. I'm hoping those are included. They weren't Saturday night's main event per se, but they were big, big network specials, like the first Andre Hogan match on live television after WrestleMania 3, the Mega Powers breakup in that match against the Twin Towers. That came on a main event special that may have aired on Friday nights. I'm hoping those are included when they get there. My guess is when the free preview week is over, we're going to get the rest of them. So there's a lot of good stuff on the network. For me, it's still a steal. $9.99 a month. You can't beat that. That price is not going to be the same a year from now. I could almost guarantee it. But I still feel like they're dropping the ball big time on this network, because there's so much stuff that they promised that they have not delivered on. You know, and there was even a note this week in the Figure 4 newsletter, F4W, and I didn't even really realize this, but they make a good point that earlier in the year when they first made the announcement about the network, they made specific claims, for example, about the home video library, and they were very vague on what that meant. But when you hear that as a fan, I think, okay, they're going to update, you know, a lot of their more recent DVD titles. Maybe they'll even go back in the vault and they'll put up a lot of those old Coliseum video releases. You know, as a longtime fan, that's something that I would be interested in. I used to collect those videos when I was younger. I still have some of them. Why not get that up as part of your home video library on demand? And they haven't done that. Not only have they not done that, but they ended up walking that statement back. They would have Michael Cole go on Raw. This was, again, earlier in the year, shortly after the network launched. And I think they said up to 50 home video titles. So already they were going back on what they had originally promised. And now there is no section on the network for specifically home video releases. There's almost none of that up. And a lot of the shows that they started uploading at the beginning, you know, World Class Championship Wrestling, Old School, which is a lot of old house show events from Madison Square Garden, from Boston Garden, from L.A., they were updating that, and they haven't in weeks, maybe months. They just stopped, dead. No explanation as to why. So you have these sections on the network that are almost incomplete. Not almost incomplete, they are incomplete. And I understand if they're not going to put everything that they have in their archives up at once, but they could be doing a hell of a lot better in terms of getting this stuff up. They made promises that they haven't kept their word on, and it's no wonder that they're worried that people, when their 6 months are up, they're not going to sign up again. You know, my brother is one of those people. When his 6 months are up next month, he's done. You know, partially because he knows he's got my login when I'm not using it. But there are a lot of people like him out there who, even though I think it's a steal, you know, $10 a month to them, it's not worth it, because the stuff they're looking for on the network just isn't there and it's not being uploaded fast enough. You know, and then I think about things that they could be doing to help make the network more of a must-see service. And look, when I say this, I'm not saying that these things I'm mentioning here are the sole reasons that are going to get people to sign up, but I'll give you an example. This weekend, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, in more depth, but there was a major talent signing in Japan. WWE was in Japan for a series of shows. They had a show in Osaka, and they had the signing in the ring of Kenta, who signed his WWE contract. Hulk Hogan was there. Jimmy Hart was there. They made a big deal about it on WWE.com, on social media. They have video of it up on YouTube. That's all well and good. To me, I don't understand if you've got this network and you're trying to portray it as a real network, I don't understand how you don't air something like that, whether it's live or on tape delay, whatever, on the network. You break in with, you know, like a special news report and you have something up for 15 minutes, for 30 minutes. You can have somebody like Renee Young anchoring it, or not. You know, it can't be that expensive to take the footage of the Kenta signing, and even if it doesn't air live, break in on the network and air something like that. That's a big deal. There was none of that. They don't do that sort of thing, but that right there is an example of something that they should be doing, and it doesn't cost them a lot of money to break in. You know, let's say you've got somebody over there already in Japan, and they can just, you know, stand in front of a camera, narrate a report. You splice in the footage of Hogan in the ring with Kenta, which they put up on YouTube anyway, slap a taped report together, and a few hours later, you throw it up on the network. Breaking news. Make it a big deal. But they didn't do that. House shows. I had this debate with somebody on Twitter. I think that airing footage from house shows on the network on a even semi-regular basis would be a good idea. Now, I'm not saying that people are going to spend $10 a month to watch house shows on the network. I'm not even saying you should air full house shows necessarily. You could if there's a big show at Madison Square Garden or something. You don't even have to do it live. You could do it the day after if you're worried about people who might not buy a ticket because they figure, oh, I can just sit at home and watch it on the network. You could do it any way you want to, but that's the sort of thing that you should be doing. You know, you're not going to do house shows every week because then people see the repetitive nature. A lot of the cards are the same, but there's a way to do it, and you feature it as network-exclusive content. You can't find this anywhere else except the WWE Network, and you can do it on the cheap. It's not airing on television. There is no satellite feed. So there's a way to do this sort of stuff, and the fact that they either haven't thought of it or they're just electing not to do it blows my mind, because the one thing that this network needs more than anything else is current network exclusive content. They kind of do that already with Main Event, but that's not enough. And the archive footage, I'm a big fan of the old footage. I'm one of those fans who will buy the network, who has bought the network largely because of the tape library, that and the pay-per-views. Some people don't give a shit about the old footage. Or they say they do, but guess what? If you look at their viewing habits, how often do they really sit there and watch old episodes of Raw on the network? It's probably not happening a lot. So you have a lot of people who don't care about that. They want current stuff. They want something like a Legends House, which apparently is on the back burner now with cost cutting. There may not even be a second season. Tough Enough. A lot of Tough Enough fans out there. If Tough Enough even happens now, again, cost cutting, it's been bumped back production until October. Now, that stuff is expensive, so I kind of get that if they want to hold off on that, because that is pricey. You know, reality shows are very expensive, but that's what I think what people are looking for. They want current stuff. The best thing you could do is take some of the current action and feature it somehow on the network as exclusive content that you can't find on YouTube, you can't find on WWE.com, you're not going to watch it on TV, you can only find it on the network. So why they're not already trying and experimenting with stuff like this, I have no idea. I remember that they made the announcement that this summer they were going to launch a news program, similar maybe to like SportsCenter on ESPN. I could have sworn that Jonathan Coachman went on Twitter and announced that he had signed a deal or was going to be signing a deal with WWE. They wanted him. You know, he still works for ESPN, but he would anchor a special news show on the network. That sounded pretty cool to me. Haven't heard a peep about that recently. And somebody asked Coachman on Twitter about it. You know, aren't you going back to WWE? Aren't you doing this? And he made a comment to the effect of, I guess they don't want me. So I guess whatever agreement they may have had has soured. But that's the sort of thing they should be doing. And they're not, and you have a lot of people who are very unhappy with the network, and that's going to be a big problem for them going forward. They've got to make changes to the network to bring people in. You can give as many free weeks out as you want to. Give people a free week and give them, you know, Sheamus versus Alberto Del Rio on Main Event, match number 5,864. That's not going to make a damn bit of difference. You've got to go beyond that. You've got to do more than that, and I hope they do, because I want to see the network succeed. I like the network, and I want to see it around for a long time to come. I just want more content. They got to put more content out there, or this thing is going to be a flop. So we got a lot of stuff to get to this week, including a special Attitude Era Raw review later in the show. This is not the new weekly thing. This is this week's special feature. There's a specific reason why I'm doing it, and it was interesting to go back and watch an entire episode of Raw from 1998, so I'll have full thoughts on that at the end of the show. But first, couple stories to get to before we get to the Raw review, And the first thing I want to just talk about here is this story that appeared in The Atlantic, or on The Atlantic website, this week about the race problem in WWE. It was a story by Dion Barry. And my big takeaway from the article the first time I read through it was apparently The Rock is not black anymore. Did you know that? Because I didn't. Apparently The Rock lost his blackness somewhere along the way. And that's a shame because the article I thought was very good. And the article makes a lot of very valid points, gives a lot of examples over the years, recently and in the past in WWE, African-American superstars who have only been able to ascend to a certain level. They've never been the world. I'm not talking about the world heavyweight title. I'm talking about the WWE champion, the representative of the company, the face of the company. And I've talked about the Booker T thing from WrestleMania 19, which was for the world title, and the way that whole storyline unfolded. And he talks about it in the article. I'm happy that he did. And really, the whole genesis of that feud, it wasn't you're not good enough because you came from, you know, WCW. It wasn't even about that. It was, you know, like he says, I'm who I am, that being Triple H. You're the black dude who shows up on TV and is good for comedy and dances, and that's all well and good, but you can't be what I am. That was the whole basis of that feud. And you would think, okay, well, that's kind of trashy, but, you know, in the end, if Booker T gets his comeuppance, it's all fine, right? It's all well and good. And of course, he didn't. And he got beat at WrestleMania with one pedigree, and it took Triple H about 5,000 years to crawl over for the pin, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, he makes a lot of good points in the story, but to me, it's almost ruined because he didn't mention The Rock. And for those of you saying, oh, but he did mention The Rock, you know, Dwayne Johnson is mentioned. Yes, Dwayne Johnson is mentioned in there because hours after he put the story up, my guess is what happened here is he saw the comments in the comments section under the story that called him out on the fact that he did this entire story, much of which is very valid, makes a lot of very good points about, you know, this issue of race in WWE over the years and a lot of the black superstars that have come and gone. And he neglected to mention Dwayne Johnson, one of the most popular superstars and champions in the history of the company, who is, in fact, part black. And they called him out on it, and so he added a little tiny paragraph to the story on Dwayne Johnson, and he even put a little asterisk next to it that mentioned, updated for clarity. Yeah. Updated for clarity, my ass. Updated because you saw people calling you out on it in the comments section, and he decided to go back and edit the story. So when I first made comments about it on Twitter, people called me out on it and said, well, he did mention The Rock. You have to read a little bit better. Actually, the story I read did not have The Rock in it, and it was added after the fact. And my two cents on it is this. I am not denying the overall argument of the piece, but to conveniently leave out The Rock in that original version is being intellectually dishonest. And it makes the author look like he's hiding that fact on purpose just to suit his own agenda. That's the problem. And it's an agenda that has a lot of truth to it. But it gets overshadowed because he failed to mention that, you know, that one little fact that one of the biggest stars in the history of the company is in fact part black. You know, and not only that, he got his first real break as part of the like a Black Panther type faction. So, you know, now you're going to have people who argue he's not really black. He's only part black. I've had people email this to me before because I've answered questions in the mailbag about this before. Why hasn't there been, you know, a black WWE champion and all that kind of, and I know what they're getting at. I know what they mean when they say that, but you can't, you know, it's like you still can't ignore the fact that he has a black father and a Samoan mother. It's part of who he is. You can't just pretend that it doesn't exist because he's too light-skinned, you know, to be identified that way. It's like when Obama won the election, and rightfully it was a big story because he was the first black U.S. president, and there were people who said, oh, it doesn't count. He's not really black. He's not really the first black president. He's mixed race. His mother was white. So what does that make him, a mutt? So it doesn't count? I mean, enough with the shades of black. This isn't Home Depot. He's not a fucking carpet sample. So the author went back. He added a paragraph mentioning he said The Rock is of African descent. And he did the right thing by adding it in. But it should have been in there to begin with. And that was really what a lot of the talk about the story was about that first day or two. instead of it being about the actual story, it was about what wasn't in the story, and that was kind of the sad part about the whole thing. I'm not arguing that Rock wasn't pushed more, maybe on television, as being Samoan, or maybe he even identifies more with being Samoan than he does being black. I don't know. You'd have to ask him. But that doesn't change his DNA. That's my point. So the article is good. I would say it's worth a read. He does make a lot of valid points, but that little omission there at the beginning bothered me. And I maintain, I don't think Vince McMahon himself is a racist. There may have been plenty of racist people who worked for that company and maybe still do. I don't think Vince himself is one. I think that if the next coming of Bobby Lashley came along today in WWE, big jacked up dude, better promo skills than Lashley, ton of charisma, okay, think Bob Sapp, only he could actually wrestle, I think they'd put the belt on that guy. I believe that. I really do. Maybe not right away, but he would be in the mix. And like Lashley did, he would have a shot at becoming the first, you know, in people's eyes, black WWE champion, even though we already had one. They would have put the belt on Lashley eventually had he not left. I've said that before too. He was on the fast track. He was in maybe the biggest match, if you want to look at it from a business perspective, in the history of WrestleMania. That Battle of the Billionaires. I mean, believe me, I'm sure people didn't buy that pay-per-view to see Bobby Lashley against Umaga. They bought it to see the whole Vince Trump deal and who was going to get their head shaved. But it was a big deal who they picked to be in that match. And they picked Bobby Lashley to be Donald Trump's, or as Donald Trump called him, Bobby Lindsay. Couldn't even get his fucking name right. But that was a big spot for him to be in. They would not have put him in that spot if they thought he was going to be out of the company in a year or two. So I think there were big things in his future. He didn't stick around long enough for various reasons to get to that point. Now, of course, he's the champion in TNA. It just, in WWE, never got to that point. But take a look at the story if you haven't seen it yet. It's long. It's a very long story. But overall, I think it is worth a look and probably worth a discussion. I don't think it's going to change a damn thing in WWE. It's not going to be the catalyst for some major change. But it's still worth a few minutes of your time. Kenta, I mentioned him earlier. He was officially introduced in Osaka. There was a WWE live event Saturday in Osaka, Japan. Hulk Hogan was flown in. I think they credited the signing, like in storyline, to Hulk Hogan, like it's his first big signing. He was there with Jimmy Hart, who's kind of his minder, I guess you would call him. And WWE put a press release out. They are calling him, at least for now, by his name. I mean, his name is Kenta. Kenta Kobayashi is his real name, but his wrestling name was Kenta, in all caps. They put a press release out. It's not all caps, but they did call him Kenta. Called him one of Japan's biggest stars and said he is, in fact, headed to WWE's NXT division. And they said, Kenta's intense and straightforward in-ring style has led to his success in Japan, as well as during visits to the U.S. He is expected to reach new heights of global success with WWE and Triple H as Paul Levesque, the Executive Vice President of Talent, Creative, and Live Events. And Kenta is an incredible performer who brings the crowd to its feet when he steps into the ring. Our signing reflects our continued dedication to creating a diverse roster that appeals to our global fan base. So he's going to NXT. I don't think there was any real question about that. Sin Cara, I think, was the last big star that bypassed developmental and went right to the main roster and didn't exactly work out too well. So maybe they're a little more gun-shy about that. So they're sending Kenta to NXT. Obviously, he doesn't have to go to NXT. He's a perfectly fine professional wrestler on his own, but they're going to want to break him into the WWE style. Probably tone down some of his style would be my guess. And he's relocating to Orlando. Maybe he'll use the Kenta name after all. We'll see. They could still give him a different name once he actually gets there. I think it would be completely stupid, being that they already made the announcement, they have the video up, they put a press release out, they're calling him Kenta. Why change the name at this point? You know, when they introduced Sin Cara at that press conference in Mexico, they called him the performer formerly known as Mystico, now known as Sin Cara. So on day one at that press conference, they announced his new WWE name. Maybe they won't do that with Kenta. Maybe they'll actually just call him by that name. My question is this, and I've seen a lot of Kenta's matches. I've seen him live. He's done Ring of Honor matches in the past in New York City, and I've been there for those. I don't know if Kenta speaks English, or if so, how well. If he does, my bet is it's probably not very good. I think if he spoke fluent English, he probably would have spoken and said something on the microphone at that event on Saturday. He didn't. He didn't say a word. It was Hogan who did all the talking. And they shook hands and they did, you know, the photo ops and all that kind of stuff. You know, I went searching on YouTube for Kenta promos. I couldn't even find any. So I don't know how much English he speaks. If he does, if he's fluent in it, my guess would be not. But I don't know. That right there, that question, the answer to that question is going to be a big indicator, I think, of how far he goes. Sin Cara, you know, I remember when he came in and the stories about the guy who portrayed the character, they wanted him to learn English. And they pushed him to, and they said, you have to learn English, and he didn't. Or maybe he tried, and then obviously it didn't work out too well. He didn't seem to be very interested in learning English, and so that right there doomed him from the start. If I'm Kenta, you've got to learn English, because you're never going to get beyond a certain point in WWE unless you can speak the language. Promos are so important. I want to see him do well. I want to see Kenta become the first Japanese talent that WWE signs to actually come over and be pushed as something more than just a comedy character and not the next Jimmy Wang Yang, okay? I want to see him do big things and wrestle main events at some point, even if it's years down the road, because I think he has that potential. It's not going to happen if he can't speak English. You know, and you could stick a manager with him, like a Paul Heyman, and let him be the mouthpiece. He's got to be able to speak English. So I don't know if he does or not. Maybe somebody can clue me in on that. I've tried, you know, to find out, and I don't know for sure. But that's something he's going to have to work on. And the other question is his moveset. People have asked me, is he going to, you know, retain the go to sleep? That was his move. He invented it, or at least he popularized it in Japan, and CM Punk stole it from him. And Daniel Bryan, you know, the flying knee, the Busaiku knee, that was Kenta's move. Kenta has really innovated quite a number of moves that have been stolen. I heard somebody even say that the tarantula in the ropes, which I first saw, you know, I first saw Tajiri do that many years ago, but they said that was a Kenta move, and now AJ Lee uses it. And are they going to let him use the GTS? My guess would be no. If they wanted to stick it to CM Punk, I guess they could. But I think he probably would get some backlash from some of the fans here for stealing Punk's move. So my guess is the GTS is probably out. The flying knee. I mean, a flying knee is a flying knee. Anybody can use that. He'll probably have to just come up with a new moveset. I would be shocked if they let him use the GTS as a finish. And the thing about Kenta using the GTS, from what I've seen of him, when he nails the GTS, he nails the GTS. He doesn't really know how to pull it very well, and so that's not going to fly if he starts delivering the GTS on NXT and breaking people's noses. Might be worthwhile for him to come up with a different move to use. I mean, can you imagine the next NXT special on the network? It sounds like they're going to have one in September, so it's not going to happen there. But let's say they have one at the end of the year, like in December. And let's say that Kevin Steen does sign, as he is expected to very shortly, if he hasn't already. Prince Devitt on his way in. They haven't announced it, but they will soon. If they get those guys, and they already have Kenta, can you imagine, let's say at the end of the year, if they're able to promote an NXT special for the network with a lineup of Sami Zayn against Kevin Steen, given how well they work together, Kenta against Prince Devitt, and you round that thing out with an NXT title match, Adrian Neville against, you know, Tyler Breeze. I'm sure by then Tyler Breeze will have already gotten his title match, but you could really have a lineup of like three or four solid matches that would get people very excited, and it might be a draw for some of those hardcore wrestling fans to be like, you know what, shit, I don't give a crap about main event, but Sami Zayn and Kevin Steen, Prince Devitt and Kenta, I'm signing up for the network for that alone. Speaking of major events at house shows in WWE, earlier in the week, Santino Marella, he made the announcement. It was actually a week ago. It was last Sunday at the live event in Toronto, which is where he lives, that he has retired as an active wrestler. He cited his history of neck problems, including, I guess there's a new issue with his neck that just creeped up on him, as the reason why he was hanging it up. I just made the comment on last week's podcast that Santino may not have much time left, and the very next day he announces his retirement. So this was not a big surprise, because it was already being murmured about. He recently opened up his own school in Toronto called the Battle Arts Academy for wrestling and MMA training. He did say he would be staying on with the company in a different capacity, whether that means as a GM or not, I don't know. I hope to God that's not the case. You know, as long as the authority is around, there is no need for a general manager. So I'm sure they could find a different role for him, maybe as an ambassador and do charity stuff. And I'm sure we have not seen the last of Santino on television. He'll pop up to do comedy cameos, kind of like Ron Simmons does. They'll trot him out there every now and then to say, damn, and then he'll disappear for 6 months. But just to look back on Santino's career, if this is it for him, you know, he signed a developmental deal with WWE back in 05. And I've talked about, I answered a question not too long ago on this podcast about the Jim Cornette incident in, I think it was Ohio Valley, when Morello was there as one of the new students sitting in the audience. They were trying to get this boogeyman character over as this terrifying monster. And instead, there's Morello sitting in the crowd laughing, trying to hold in his laughter. And Cornette just snapped. And backstage afterwards, he started smacking him around. And that really led to Cornette's dismissal from WWE, and he hasn't been back since. So that was a famous or infamous incident, I should probably say. He made his debut on television in 07. Raw was in Milan, Italy. They had one of their rare international shows, and they decided to debut him as a local fan coming out of the crowd, and he wrestled Umaga for the Intercontinental title. Ended up winning the championship with an assist from Bobby Lashley, hence his nickname, the Milan Miracle. That's where it came from. He would go on to hold the U.S. title. He was a tag team champion as well. He became one of the most popular, successful comedy characters in the history of that company. You know, he did thing. He did a lot of fun things, especially early on in his run. It kind of, I mean, I think his act kind of got old towards the end. He could still be very funny. You know, he was still good for comedy relief every now and then. But I just kind of get tired of his act more recently. He did things like the honk-a-meter back when he was the Intercontinental Champion. He would keep track of his time as the champion. He was trying to break Honky Tonk Man's streak, which still stands, by the way. I think it's like 15 months as the Intercontinental Champion. He did the Glamorella pairing with Beth Phoenix, dressed up as a woman named Santina to win Miss WrestleMania. Still holds the record for fastest elimination in a Royal Rumble, 1.9 seconds. The Cobra gimmick, which he popularized, the Cobra sock puppet deal, was very popular at first. Then I just think it got way out of control. That stupid shit they did with 3MB and the Great Khali and the snake charming stuff, remember that? Just horrendous. Horrendous stuff. And when they paired Santino off with Emma and gave her a pink cobra, it just felt like a death sentence for the girl. Her not being with Santino anymore is a blessing. I know she has her other issues with what happened last week with the arrest and everything. Hopefully that's not held against her and that's behind her. And her not being with Santino will force them to come up with something better. I mean, I know the pairing with Santino got her TV time. Okay, she hasn't been on television in weeks without him. So you could say, well, the pairing with Santino was good for her because it actually got her on television. That's true, but now I'm hoping that this forces them to come up with something better for her to get her on television, you know? You can get TV time doing the stupidest shit in the world, but at what cost, you know? What damage is it doing to your career? I'd rather she be off TV until they actually find something productive for her to do, although I don't know, again, how the whole shoplifting stuff may affect that going forward. I guess we'll see. How long it takes for her to get back on TV, and if she's doing jobs, or if they actually come up with a program for her. My favorite Santino memory, if I had to pick one easily, was the Tea Time with Santino segment they did with him and Sheamus and Kozlov on Raw from the UK. I want to say that was back in 2010. It was either 3 or 4 years ago. That right there is an example of comedy done right in WWE, and I think Sheamus at one point was kind of corpsing on camera, trying so hard not to laugh, even he found it funny. You could find that segment, I'm sure, on YouTube. It was great, and it was probably my favorite thing that Santino has been involved in. There was, you know, a little period those first couple of months in 2011, and that was the year they did the one and only 40-man Royal Rumble. Del Rio won that year. Think about that. Alberto Del Rio winning the Royal Rumble. The thought now of that is just comical. But Santino was the last guy in that Rumble match with Del Rio. And you would think, oh, that sucks. You know, Santino's a jobber. What a way to build drama. But he was so over. Like, people loved him so much as that underdog, undercard character. Kind of like what Eric Young was for many years in TNA. that they wanted so desperately for him to win that Royal Rumble. There was no thought given to the fact that the winner of this match is going to go on to headline WrestleMania, and that could in fact be Santino Marella. People just wanted to see him win. It was actually one of the better Rumble finishes they've ever done, especially in terms of how loud the crowd was for it, because I think Santino was kind of forgotten about, and Del Rio threw somebody out, they thought he won, but then in the background you see Santino, and he's putting the Cobra thing on, and it's like, holy shit, I forgot he was even in the match, and you thought for a split second he might win. Of course he didn't, but you thought he might, and that was cool. And the following month, he actually ended up in one of the Elimination Chamber matches for the World Heavyweight title. He won a Battle Royal to earn a spot in the Chamber match. Randy Orton was out with a concussion. They had a spot that needed to be filled, so they had this Battle Royal. He won. He went to the match. And if I remember correctly, I think he was, much like the Rumble with Del Rio, he was the last guy in there with Daniel Bryan, who was the world champion at the time. And people were going nuts. I remember the crowd heat for the end of that Chamber match was off the charts. It's fucking Daniel Bryan back when he was, you know, nobody. And Santino Marella, and the people are going nuts like it's the main event of WrestleMania. And they were hoping he might win, and then he got locked in the S-lock, or the LaBelle lock, it might have still been called at the time, and he tapped out. But that was probably the most high-profile period for him in his entire career. You know, he was, you know, in the Rumble match at the very end, he was in a Chamber match on pay-per-view, getting a pay-per-view payoff, wrestling for the world title. I don't think he ever quite got back up to that level, but hey, when they put him in there, he delivered, and the people were into it, and you got to give him that. So to me, those two matches, the Tea Time segment on Raw, those are my most memorable memories of Santino Marella. And, you know, all the best to him. Hopefully he gets his neck fixed. It's not fun having neck problems. A lot of guys, Edge, you know, have had their careers end because of their neck. I don't know if the surgery he needs is major spinal fusion surgery or if it's, you know, maybe not so serious. That I don't know. And I hope they keep him around, again, for cameos every now and then. I don't need to see him as the GM or I don't need to see him on television every week. But I think when he looks back on his career, and I'm sure he is, he's got nothing to be ashamed of. He had a hell of a run. For a guy in his position, an undercard comedy guy, to have, what, 7 years, 8 years on the main roster, you know, and a lot of times doing stuff that, you know, was pretty important or people were into, not too many people can say that. So I think when you really look back on it, he had a pretty good run. Raw this past Monday night was in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. No authority to open the show. First time in months we've had a Raw open up without Triple H or Stephanie coming out. And wouldn't you know, things seemed to run just fine in their absence without any authority figure in charge. Matches were made, just like the old days. I guess some random entity, some random ghost, made matches. Everybody knew who their opponent was. They didn't need somebody to come out at the beginning of the show and tell them. We didn't need somebody there to make them up as the night went on. It's amazing how that works. I told you the GM position was useless. I've been saying it for years. And by the way, the authority, they announced they're on vacation. And so in the middle of the show, Zack Ryder posts a tweet that says, and I guess this will be this week's sad tweet. I wasn't going to do sad tweet this week, but we may as well do it here. He posted a tweet that said, "I'm on vacation too," with a photo of himself sitting at home watching Raw on TV. And somebody suggested, you know, if you're going to do this segment, you should call it the Zack Ryder Memorial said tweet. And I might have to consider doing that, but there was no topping it. Like, at that point, I knew there was no point in even looking at any other tweets during the week. That's it. You know, maybe it'll be a running gag. You know, maybe Zack Ryder will get the honors every single week. We'll just make it a segment about him. It was also a hard sell on this show for the free preview week of the network, which they had to do. It's just the nature of things. You've got to promote the network. They probably should have been doing this a long time ago, to be honest with you. The hard sells on these shows, I mean, I know it gets tiring after a while, but I'm okay with that because they should be telling people why the network is such a big deal and why they should subscribe. It's almost like, you know, they'll run commercials for it every now and then about how the network works. They'll have Kofi Kingston in a suit explaining how to, you know, access the network and what's available and everything. And they'll run shit like that for a week or two, and then you'll never see it again. They should be airing that fucking commercial every single week, every single hour, each of the 3 hours of Raw. It's almost like they're not doing enough to promote their own network. They'll promote the app, but they won't promote the network like they'll promote the app. Explain to me what sense that makes. We have Roman Reigns out there for the opening segment of the show, cutting a promo. One of the lines here, one of the best lines, maybe the line of the night, actually, was Roman Reigns was standing in the middle of the ring, and in the middle of his promo, people started chanting, "Cena sucks." Of course, John Cena, one of his opponents at Battleground, in the Fatal 4-Way. And Roman Reigns just hears this, and he says, "When Roman Reigns is in the house, you're damn right Cena sucks." Place went nuts. It's no surprise to me that the best part of the Roman Reigns promo on Monday night is the one part that seemed the most improvised. You know, when Reigns is allowed to be himself and just act like a badass and talk like a badass, or when he's doing an interview with Renee Young backstage and he goes into Playboy mode, he's at his most appealing on the microphone. The people who crapped all over this promo, and there were a lot of people who thought this was a bad promo and that Roman Reigns looked lost. I don't think he looked lost. But for all the people who were crapping all over this promo, you know, and saying, other people saying, "Well, you're being too harsh," they have a point. I'm not saying those people don't have a point. You know, a lot of the dialogue seems very forced when it comes out of his mouth because it doesn't sound like something you would ever hear this man say if he was looking you dead in your eye and he was threatening you. Now, that being said, when Kane came out and Reigns called him Orton's bitch, that was the second best line of the segment, and the crowd reacted big. I like how they're letting him straddle the PG line as much as possible. That's important because this guy is the heir apparent. You know, he is. He's next in line to the throne, and they need him to get over with the fans, and they need him to win their approval. He's not going to do that by becoming John Cena 2.0. He's got to be his own man. Like it or not, this guy is the next big thing. He's the chosen one. Daniel Bryan is gone for the foreseeable future. With the neck injury, now I read in this week's Observer newsletter, he may also need shoulder surgery. Apparently they did some tests, they found his shoulders all fucked up, he may need surgery on that. You know, he ain't coming back anytime soon. They need Roman Reigns to work. They need this experiment with him to work. And I think that this was a good night for him. The fans were into him. I thought his promo a little shaky, but I think it's more to do with him having to remember the stupid dialogue that they script for him. And when he goes off script a little bit and he reacts to the fans, all of a sudden, it's like, wow, that was awesome. This Roman Reigns promo is great. If you take that line out about how, you know, when I'm in the ring, you damn right Cena sucks, and maybe the line about Orton being a bitch, what do you have? You have every other scripted, phony-sounding promo that they give that dialogue to everybody else on the roster. Those little moments made you remember that promo, and I guarantee you that line about Cena was not in the script. It was not something he memorized. It was something that he reacted to. And I'd like to see more of that. I wish they would let guys do that more often. We had Luke Harper and Eric Rowan beating the Usos in a non-title match. Harper finished one of the Usos off with a lariat. Usos complained post-match that he pinned the illegal man, but the referee's decision, as we all know in wrestling, is final, except when they don't want it to be. This was really good. I am looking forward to the title match of Battleground. 2 out of 3 falls is the stipulation for the match. Not for nothing, the Battleground card is shaping up to be quite excellent on paper. Between this match, Rollins against Ambrose now is official. Jericho and Bray Wyatt is official. Paige and AJ, I'm still waiting for them to go out there and have that great match I think they could have together. Even the Battle Royal, you know, has the potential to be good. So this card's looking pretty good right now. We had what was then a gigantic waste of time. I can't even call it a match. I don't even think the bell ever rang. It was Nikki Bella having one arm tied behind her back. It was supposed to be her and Alicia Fox having their arms tied behind their back. The referee tied Nikki's arm first. I knew exactly where this was going. He went to go tie Alicia's hand. She got all crazy psycho on him. Never had her hand tied, but she went and beat the crap out of Nikki, who was a one-armed woman, in an ass-kicking contest. That never works out well. And the crowd didn't give two shits. They really just did not care about any of this at all. Alicia was doing her crazy thing, and she poured soda, I think, on her. And then it just ended. The segment just ended. That was it. And again, no sign of John Cena. Hell of a boyfriend. John Cena, you know, it's weird. Like, they talk about him being the super babyface that he is. And more and more, he reminds me of Hogan back in the day. Hogan was the ultimate, like, supreme babyface in WWE for so many years. But when you really paid attention to Hogan and his matches and the way he wrestled and the way he brawled, what did Hogan do when he was in the ring? Besides the big boot and the leg drop, what did he do? He gave people a back rake. He raked the eyes. He would choke every now and then. All these heel tactics that Hogan would do. And Jesse Ventura on commentary would just go nuts. He would be like, oh, well, if this were, if Hogan's opponent were doing this, he wouldn't be saying it was okay. And of course, the babyface announcer would always be like, well, turnabout's fair play. And I would always side with Jesse. I'm like, the guy has a point. Hogan, at heart, is a heel. And I kind of see more of that in Cena, because when was the last time John Cena came out to really save somebody that was close to him? His girlfriend is out there, and this isn't the first time. She's out there getting her ass kicked. She got her ass kicked even more a few weeks ago. He was nowhere to be found. It's not like they don't acknowledge the two of them are together. They openly acknowledge it now with Total Divas. You can't ignore the fact that they are together. His girlfriend is out there with one arm behind her back getting her ass kicked. Daniel Bryan, week after week, would go out there. Kane, that one time, tombstoned him three different times. Where was Cena? Go ask Zack Ryder, who ended up in a body cast. The John Cena character does not give a shit about you. He cares about himself. That is a heel. Anyway, so to go back to this debacle here. The announcers. Got to talk about the announcers. They said that per the authority, Nikki and Alicia will have a match with each of them having one arm tied behind their back. Okay, we've established this. Fast forward 2 minutes into the segment, and Michael Cole then says, you have to wonder if the authority is behind this. Actually, no, I don't have to wonder, because you just told me that they're behind this. The commentary was atrocious on the show this week. And I'm using that, he was told to say that, I'm sure. But this goes to a larger point about how bad the commentary was on this show. Just terrible. And it wasn't just this match, it was the entire show. They distract from what's going on in the ring. Cole, yeah, I have to say this about Michael Cole. He works hard. I don't envy having the Irish madman in his ear trying to juggle 5,000 plugs over a three-hour show for the app and the network and the hashtags and everything else they ask the guy to do. But it doesn't change the fact that the announcing, I think, does more to take away from the show than it does to add to it, which I always thought was the point of the commentary, not to entertain themselves at the expense of what we're seeing on TV. You know, during the Sheamus Sandow match, when Sandow was dressed up as Bret Hart, JBL kept, all of a sudden he's screaming about a screw job. He was screwed. Bret screwed Bret. He kept shouting this for some reason. I wish we had a kill switch for the announcers. I really do. But then you look at the picture, you know, what's the alternative? That's part of the problem. Who else is out there that's ready to be put into that position? Jim Ross is gone. They got rid of Josh Matthews, but you know, he wasn't the answer anyway. They got rid of him. They're easing Renee Young into the role on the B shows, right? Now she's one of the commentators on Superstars. Supposedly the plan is for her to eventually end up on SmackDown and maybe even make her way to Raw and be part of the announced team on Raw, although I think that's probably a long, you know, many, many, many months down the road. But it looks like they've got a battle plan for her, and they're going to want to keep her. Been a lot of rumors about ESPN having interest in her. I think her contract is going to have her in WWE for another year. My guess is she's not going to go anywhere. But there is a lot of interest out there for her. So they're easing her into, you know, the announced position, not just a backstage interviewer or an in-ring interviewer or the pre-show host, okay? Who else? Tom Phillips? Well, Tom Phillips is fine. A little too generic for me, but I suppose he could do it at some point. Byron Saxton? He's good when he's not overdoing the heel shtick like he does on NXT. I used to like Alex Riley as an announcer. Used to, being the key words. I mean, maybe it's just the character they have him portray on NXT, but he's also super annoying. Got William Regal. Regal's awesome. You know what? I could live with a Tom Phillips-William Regal combo on Raw. Give him a trial run on SmackDown or something. Let's see how they do. Tenzai, who now goes by Jason Albert. That's his new name. He's not bad. If you really, you know, the weeks that he's on NXT and they alternate, so he's only on every other week, every 2 weeks. But when he's on, from what I've heard of him so far, he's not bad. Especially for a guy who hasn't done this before. I'd like to see him get more work on the headset. There's been talk of Corey Graves possibly being done as an active wrestler because of all the concussions that he suffered. And maybe they'll move him into an announcer role and see how he does. Why not? I think he'll probably be better as a manager, but why not? They should take some of the wrestlers they're not doing anything with or that have retired and try them out as announcers. Most of the announcers you find in baseball, basketball, football, they're ex-players. They played the sport before. They grow into the role of announcer or color guy, whatever. They should be looking at these guys. Maybe that's where Christian ends up. They had him on the Money in the Bank kickoff show, and I thought he did a pretty good job. That doesn't mean he would make a great announcer. It's two totally different things, but why not try him out in the role? Santino. Santino just retired. Now, it's too bad he's still doing the stupid accent, because I've heard him speak like a normal person in interviews before, and he's a well-spoken guy. Go find the video on YouTube when he did this walkthrough of his Battle Arts Academy with him and his co-owner there. He gave people a tour of what it looks like, and it's just him being him. He's not doing the stupid Italian accent, and he, you know, he sounds great, and he's taking people around and showing them what this room does and what happens here and what happens there, and it was kind of weird listening to him at first, but after a while, I got used to it. He's a very well-spoken guy. Maybe he could have done well in a role like this, but it looks like he's going to keep doing the character, and with that accent, I have no interest in seeing Santino on commentary. They had him on the Raw post-game show a few weeks ago doing the character. He's fucking terrible. If they let him be himself, he might have a shot. But if not, then I have no interest in seeing him as an announcer. But they need to look somewhere because the pickings are slim when it comes to announcers in wrestling these days. Taz has his moments on Impact. You know, he can be very funny. But him and Mike Tenay just sound completely uninspired most of the time. Like, they don't even want to be there. Tenay was great as the third wheel on Nitro, spitting out facts about all the luchadors because Bobby Heenan and Tony Schiavone didn't know shit about them. You know, they called him the professor. He was the brain. Well, not Bobby the brain, but he was kind of the brain in terms of all the knowledge he would dispense. And, you know, when we need a wrestling fact, let's go to Tenay. He was fine in that role, but as your main play-by-play guy, he's not a play-by-play guy. He, you know, Mike Tenay, in my opinion, has never been that guy. And now it's as bad as it's ever been because he's been in that position since day one. Day one! You know, he's not that good in that role. And he's also, the other problem with Tenay, he's been there for so long in that position, he's tied in with all of those years of failure. He's got that stench on him. The old TNA, the way things used to be. There were some good years at the beginning, but a whole shitload of bad years. Including even recently. They need a new voice. Just like WWE can use some new announced talent, TNA needs a new voice. I didn't mind Todd Kennelly when they brought that Todd Kennelly guy in to do play-by-play for a while. They I guess, kind of took TNA out of that role for a little while there. But he ended up right back in that spot when they fired Kennelly. But I didn't think he was bad. You know, he brought a different voice to the table. And then they got rid of him. I think they got rid of the wrong announcer, personally. But I can't remember a period in wrestling, as long as I've been a fan, where the announcing overall has been so bad. Rusev got a win over Rob Van Dam, pretty clean, right in the middle of the ring, tapped him out to the accolade. So that was a pretty big victory right there for Rusev. That's obviously the role that they're going to use RVD in now. Jerry Lawler referred to RVD at one point as that young man. Well, I guess compared to Lawler, he would be. Randy Orton beat Dean Ambrose. Yes, another rematch from SmackDown. Not saying I don't want to see Orton versus Ambrose or that it would be a bad match, because it was actually very good. But the whole rematch thing is a running joke at this point. The moment from this match, it was a good match, but there was a blown spot in the middle of the match. And what happened is, Dean Ambrose climbed up to the top rope, and I think what was supposed to happen is he was supposed to come off, and Orton was supposed to drop kick him in midair. At least I think that's what was supposed to happen. And instead, what happened is Ambrose climbed up to the top, Orton had his back turned, and he came off the top rope. Orton never bothered turning around, and Ambrose just landed on his feet. And then Orton turned around and ended up giving him a standing drop kick instead. I so badly wanted Ambrose, once he landed, to start yelling, "Stupid! Stupid!" at Orton. Give him a taste of his own medicine, but probably for his own sake, for Ambrose's sake, good thing that he didn't do that. But it looked like Orton fucked up. But he's Randy Orton, so even if he did, it's not like it's going to matter. The finish of the match was Orton winning with an RKO. I hated that finish. I would not have even made this match in the first place if that was what they were going to do. I just think it's a big mistake to be beating Dean Ambrose that way right now. I know they're pushing Roman Reigns as the next big thing, but you could argue that Dean Ambrose is more over than Roman Reigns is right now, and that Dean Ambrose is the de facto number two babyface in the company. I think in the end, Roman Reigns will be in that spot, but people love Dean Ambrose. He's got a lot of momentum right now. He's a crazy man. He comes out there. People go nuts. People went nuts for him at Money in the Bank. The key is, though, he hasn't been beaten clean like this on television. You know, I know Kane came out a few weeks ago and chokeslammed him and screwed him. There was no screw job here. There was no illusion of a screw job. It was Randy Orton laying him out with an RKO and pinning him 1-2-3. Now, Orton is in the championship match at Battleground, and Dean Ambrose isn't, so in that respect it made sense. But guess what? Don't make the fucking match. How about that? Especially after you already did it on SmackDown. Instead, they do it again on Raw, and then they beat Ambrose clean. I don't understand that. He has a lot of momentum right now. Don't beat him clean like that. You can't find somebody else to put in that spot. You have to put Ambrose in that match. You know, there was no distraction from Seth Rollins or anything like that, you know, which is good because we've seen enough distraction finishes. Just don't make the fucking match. Didn't like that finish. In another Groundhog Day moment, Alberto Del Rio pinned Dolph Ziggler. And in other news, grass is green, water is wet. We've seen this a million times before. People desperately want to see Ziggler succeed based on these crowd reactions. They cheer for him. They go nuts for him during the near falls, but it just continues to fall on deaf ears. The win here entitled Del Rio to a U.S. title match on Main Event, last man standing style, because we have a network to sell, against Sheamus. Speaking of Groundhog Day, holy shit, I heard they had a good match. And Del Rio and Sheamus have had plenty of good matches before. It's not like they just have bad matches. So I heard they had a good match. I could not bring myself to watch it. I have seen this match so many times. I have seen enough of Sheamus and Del Rio to last 5,000 lifetimes. So I had no interest in tuning in. Back to Ziggler for a second, to the Ziggler match. Fandango was out there on commentary, ended up distracting Dolph when they played his music, and he danced on top of the announce desk. I wonder who it was who knew to play Fandango's music. Makes you wonder. But they played his music, he danced and distracted Ziggler, and Ziggler lost. Yet another distraction finish. At least it wasn't a roll-up. On SmackDown, they did the rematch for Money in the Bank. They had Summer Rae and Layla with Fandango as the referee. And this time they went with the finish that I predicted for the first match, which was Summer and Layla each turning on Fandango and leaving together. So, better late than never. I knew it was coming, it just seemed obvious to me, so I guess it came 2 weeks late. Jerry Lawler was in the ring. He introduced Bret the Hitman Hart, came out to a hero's welcome in Montreal. He's got a little bit of history there, I think. Out comes Damian Sandow, dressed up as Bret Hart in Bret's early 90s gear, which I actually liked. I wish Bret would have worn that for the match with Vince, WrestleMania 26. So he came out dressed up as Bret, calling himself Bret the Hitman Sandhart. And Sandow told Bret that talking was never Bret's strong suit, which it really wasn't. And Bret decked him and said, "You're right, punching was." And that's a shoot. That is a shoot, folks. To this day, Bret Hart still throws the best work punches in pro wrestling that I've ever seen. John Cena needs to take notes. That's what he needs to do. Sheamus came out, by the way. He beat Sandhart quickly with the brogue kick. Chris Jericho and The Miz. Now, this to me was a massive disappointment. And not just because The Miz was in there. Chris Jericho beat The Miz about 5 minutes with the Walls of Jericho in a disappointing match. And the reason I say that is because I heard that their match, their first match they had was last week, and I want to say it was in Toronto. which I guess would have been the day before Raw. I heard that match stole the show. They went out there for a hell of a lot longer than 5 minutes, and they had a great match, and they tore the house down. So I expected these guys to go out there, get some time at the top of the hour. You know, Jericho's first match back on Raw, Miz's first match back on Raw in months, and have a kick-ass match, and I would not call this a kick-ass match. It was just a match, and that's why it was disappointing. One of our listeners, Sam, tweeted me during the match to point out that Jericho was bleeding from the ear, which is true, he was. And Sam said it was because he must have been able to hear the announce team. Well done, Sam. After the match, Bray Wyatt appeared in his rocking chair in the aisle, and each man cut a promo on the other to build to their match at the pay-per-view. Paige and AJ beat the Funkadactyls, who officially broke up after the match. They brawled with one another, so there's the match that goes in the death spot at Battleground. They're doing a slow burn to Paige, turning on AJ. She was way too nice to AJ during this match, almost like bosom buddies, acting like they were best friends. Spoiler, they're not. Kofi Kingston got yet another fluke pinfall win over Cesaro. Cesaro freaked out again, beat him up. Big E ran down to stop the violence. I fail to see what is gained from Cesaro losing twice in a row to Kofi Kingston, unless it's the slow burn to Cesaro turning on Heyman, Heyman getting sick of him and turning on Cesaro, and eventually maybe building to a match with Cesaro and Brock Lesnar. I can only imagine that's why this is happening. Either that, or it just means that Cesaro is winning the Intercontinental title at Battleground, which is very possible. They can beat him every single week, knowing that he's going to win the championship at the pay-per-view. I could easily see that happening. I would not do that, because I think the Intercontinental title would probably do more harm than good to Cesaro, but that could be why we're seeing this. We had Bo Dallas beating El Torito. What a visual that was of him giving him the bow dog, which somebody on Twitter very astutely pointed out was a legitimate bulldog. He bulldogged the bull. That is the definition of a bulldog. The best part of this was you know, it was what it was. The best part of this was after the match, he goes to do his victory lap, and so Bo Dallas is running around the ring, or very casually jogging around the ring, and the camera was in perfect position. We see El Torito standing there dazed on the outside, and coming up the rear, here comes Bo Dallas, and he doesn't miss a beat. He just bumps right into El Torito, knocks him down to the ground. It's doesn't even stop, just keeps going. I there's an animated GIF that somebody put together. I couldn't stop watching it. It was awesome. That right there made this show worthwhile. Just that one little moment, that fantastic bump that El Torito took was so worth it. And the main event was John Cena against Seth Rollins. I mentioned earlier, you know, Jericho and The Miz I thought was disappointing because I expected more from them and they didn't give them any time. This was also a disappointment. It was a good match, but it was disappointing because I expected John Cena and Seth Rollins to go in there and have a great match. And maybe one day they will. I think this could be a pay-per-view main event one day, and hopefully when it is, they'll give them 15, 20 minutes to go in there and have a memorable classic match. Michael Cole, by the way, he finally acknowledged on commentary Cena as being polarizing instead of controversial as he came to the ring. Well, it's about damn time. Like I said, the match was fine, nothing special. Cena, now here's the thing. First move of the match, they grabbed a headlock, and sure enough, Cena begins loudly calling spots. I swear to God, he is the dirt worst of any main eventer I have ever seen when it comes to spot calling. I know it happens. Everybody does it. A lot of guys are able to hide it and mask it better than others. This guy is the main event. He's the number one guy in the company, okay? He's been doing this for how many years now? How many thousands of matches has he had on television? He can't hide when he calls spots in the ring. The first fucking move of the match! And he's calling moves. Finish Kane. Well, there was no finish. Cena had Rollins beat in the STF when the Demon Kane came down for the no contest. Orton came out, both attacked Cena, which brought out Roman Reigns to make the save. Rollins nailed him with the briefcase, nailed Cena with the briefcase. Tease cashing in, but Dean Ambrose came out to foil his plans once again. Hey, Dean, wait for the bell, okay, buddy? Let them ring the bell, then come down. That's the best way to screw the dude over. Show ended with Roman Reigns and John Cena each raising each other's arms to the expected crowd reaction. Cena did not seem very happy about that. By the way, they did Reigns and Rusev on SmackDown. Talk about matches. I mentioned Orton and Ambrose earlier. You talk about a match that should absolutely not be happening right now, and they throw it on SmackDown, like a throwaway match with Rusev and Reigns. It's just so idiotic to me, especially the way they did it. They actually had them in there together for a few minutes. It's not even like it was over within a minute. They were out there for a few minutes. They had Rusev put a fucking nerve hold on Roman Reigns. A fucking nerve hold. These two never should have been put in the ring together again. After that Battle Royal finish they did a few weeks ago, which got over big. Okay, after that, they should not have even been in the same ring together until it was built up as a big match down the road. Like months down the road. I don't know what they were thinking by even making this match in the first place. Like, they don't even think about the consequences of taking some of these matches that could be big-time matches down the road and just throwing them out there like nothing. And then later on, it doesn't feel as special. Keep these guys apart. We got a quick NXT review this week. Pretty basic show. We had Summer Rae opening the show with Bayley, number one contenders match, with the winner meeting Charlotte for the NXT Women's Championship at some point. I really thought Bayley was coming out of this with the win. I didn't think they would want to do what is essentially a heel versus heel match, even though they have been building tension between Summer and Charlotte. And Bayley has the history with Charlotte, and fans would really be into her quest, I think, to win the title. And hopefully they're just holding off on that for a later date. Summer Rae got the win here. She is now the number one contender for the championship. They did not announce a date for that match, but it's going to have to be sometime in the next few weeks if they're not doing another live special, possibly until September. I don't think they could go that long without giving us the match. Justin Gabriel cut a promo backstage. We don't really get a chance ever to see him do that on any of the main shows. He was back there with Tyson Kidd. Tyson Kidd just stood there, didn't say a word. And Gabriel cut a promo talking about his actions last week and why he did what he did, attacking Sami Zayn along with Tyson Kidd. Justin Gabriel said, sometimes you just have to break the rules. Sin Cara and Wesley Blake. Unless the idea here is to build Sin Cara up by giving him some wins so eventually he loses to somebody else on NXT that they're building up. I mean, who knows? Maybe they're building Sin Cara up for somebody like Bull Dempsey. Short of that, I don't know what purpose this served. It was just essentially a squash match almost. Sin Cara was out there wrestling Wesley Blake, who's a lot bigger than him and probably has at least some potential. Way more than Sin Cara does. The character is dead at this point. You know, Hunico does what he can with it. But the gimmick is, it's over. Actually, it's not over. I guess that's the problem. It's just been beaten down so much, and it's so irrelevant that this just came off to me as a waste of time. But he got the win with his senton splash, 1-2-3, and that was it. CJ Parker came out to the ring, the eco douche, CJ Parker. Xavier Woods came out in a suit, so no dancing or any of that stuff that he normally does. He was serious Xavier Woods. He was PhD Xavier Woods this week. And, you know, he's good on the microphone, but again, another guy who's never going to go above a certain level in this company because they don't see him that way. He is the guy who wrestles the guy on the way up. You know, if you think that they have any sort of plan for Xavier Woods, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I can sell you. It's not going to happen. So they went back and forth, and then CJ Parker delivered a spin kick that missed. So that was, and you could tell it missed because they didn't bother showing a replay. So it looked very weak. Xavier Woods sold it anyway, like he was dead, like he had been shot in the back of the head. Referees came out to break the two of them up as CJ Parker. He wasn't really beating him up because, again, he's a man of peace, you know, peace, love, and all that kind of crap. So he delivered the kick, I guess, because Xavier Woods pushed him. He pushed him to that point. And then he kind of grabbed him by the hair, and he was yelling at him, and referees came out to break it up, and whatever. It's building up to a match that I really don't have any interest in seeing. Bull Dempsey beat Angelo Dawkins. Another squash match just showing Bull Dempsey off and showcasing his moves and how big, I guess, and nasty he is, the last of a dying breed. You won't find too many wrestlers on the WWE roster these days who look like Bull Dempsey. And he used his bulldozer finish for the pin. And for the love of God, I will say this about Bull Dempsey. Please, please ditch the body slam finish. I don't care if you're contorting your body in such a way to make it look like it's more devastating. It's a fucking body slam, dude. Pick a different move. Main event was Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel against Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn. This right here was the match of the night. This was the best thing on the entire show. This was a really, really good match with four guys who were really, really good. Go figure. It was also the first time I've ever seen a standing shooting star press in a WWE ring. It was from Adrian Neville here. And I'm not talking from the top rope. I mean standing in the middle of the ring on Sami Zayn's back. He did a standing shooting star press, and I've never seen that before. Very impressive. The finish came. Natalya was out there in her husband's corner. Again, they're still continuing this storyline. There's trouble brewing between husband and wife. And, you know, Tyson Kidd is playing it off like, hey, you know, everything's fine. And, you know, he's got this very passive-aggressive thing going on right now. And so Natalya's out there. She gets up on the apron at one point, gets bumped off. I don't even remember how it happened, but I know Sami Zayn was in there with Tyson Kidd. Natalya took a bump. And, you know, Natalya has been a wrestler for a long time. She's a tough girl. So the idea that she would take this bump, which didn't even look all that brutal, and she'd have to sell it like, you know, she got kicked in the face, was a little over the top, but whatever. She took the bump, and Sami Zayn is looking out there like, oh my God, you know, what just happened? And Tyson Kidd is like, oh my God, what have you done? And instead of going out there to check on his wife, he used it as an opportunity to roll up Sami Zayn for the pinfall. Got the win for his team. So Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel successful. Natalya still laying on the floor, trying to recuperate. Tyson Kidd slides out of the ring. He's like Bo Dallas. After Bo Dallas wins a match, he's dancing a jig. He's as excited as anybody you'll ever see for winning a match on NXT. And then finally, this great moment where he realizes, oh shit, I should probably go check on my wife and pretend that I care. And he had this look, like that moment that he realized it, like the switch flipped, it was great. I love the way he did that. Went to go check on Natalya. She didn't seem very happy that he seemed more concerned about the win than her well-being. And that was how he went off the air. So I like the stories they were telling. The action was really good. Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville are obviously great. We already know that. They were actually both wrestling against each other on the Japanese tour. They took them overseas. So would not shock me at all if either or both of these guys ended up on the main roster sometime this summer. I think Sami Zayn certainly is more than due for a promotion to the main roster. So hopefully that comes sooner rather than later. But that was NXT. Fine hour of wrestling. Nothing terribly exciting. But if you're looking for a great main event, you'll find it here. So check that out, and we will be back in just a moment with thoughts on Impact from this past Thursday night. Thank you guys for taking time out of your day to listen to The Sound Off. I get questions from people asking, how can I support the podcast? Well, the best way to support the show is simple. Just keep listening each and every week. Keep spreading the word about it to friends and family, and retweet or share links to the episodes on Twitter and Facebook. But beyond that, you can contribute by making a PayPal donation or by signing up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. Making a PayPal donation is simple. Just log on to thesolemonster.com and you'll see the PayPal donation box on the right-hand side of the page. Enter whatever amount you'd like and click the Make a Donation button. That's it. Or sign up for a free Audible trial by entering our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. From there, you can sign up free for 30 days, which helps us out. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep no matter what. And you can browse through their library of over 150,000 titles. Listen to your books at home, on the commute to work, at the gym, whenever, wherever. Sign up at audibletrial.com/solemonster or visit thesolemonster.com to make a donation right now. And thank you for supporting The Sound Off. Impact on Thursday night was the last of the Bethlehem tapings, which means that next Thursday is the first of the New York City tapings and the first taping with the six-sided ring back. So this was the final show that we're going to see the regular four-sided ring in TNA. This was the TNA Champion Showcase, according to Kurt Angle. He came out at the beginning of the show running down all the matches for the evening, including a Battle Royal. We haven't had enough of those recently, with the winner getting a title shot against Lashley next week in New York City. He called out Willow. This could be the last time I use that impression, so I may as well. Angle says he needs Jeff Hardy in that Battle Royal tonight. He says he's not asking for Willow to disappear forever. I am. But that's not what he said. He says, for tonight, he needs Hardy. And so anyway, this appeared to be the blow-off for the Willow character, at least for now, so thank God for that. Wolves beat Bram and Magnus to retain their TNA Tag Team titles. Bram and Magnus laid waste to them after the match. Good match, but the Wolves are capable of so much more, and I feel like they don't have that tag team in TNA to really oppose them. There's been a lot of talk that TNA is very interested in signing Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish, Red Dragon, away from Ring of Honor. Hey, if they could float more money in their faces, and if you've got, let's say, Davey Richards going through back channels talking to these guys saying, hey, you know, come on over, we'll work with you guys, I could see that happening. I could see them coming over, and that could be a hell of a feud in TNA if they can get those guys. But until that day happens, and because Bad Influence is gone, the Wolves don't really have anybody on their level to work with. You know, the Bromans are not at their level. Bram and Magnus are not at their level. I mean, who else is there? So they need better opponents. Austin Aries beat Seiya Sanada. Really, really good match to, retain. He actually regained the X Division Championship, making him a five-time champion. It also means that at the end of the month, I think July 31st, I want to say, is the date of the Destination X edition of Impact. Austin Aries now has the option to trade in the title for a shot at the World Heavyweight title. Option C, as Aries first conceived of many years ago. This was the best Sanada match I've seen since he came to TNA. I thought that they went out there and they laid it all on the line. They gave them some time, and what we ended up with, like I said before, was a really good match. Am I the only one who cringes every time Aries jumps from the top rope out to the floor for the double axe handle? I cringe for his knees. You know, I know what that did to Randy Savage's knees after all those years. I don't want to see Austin Aries end up the same way. Both guys kicked out of each other's finishers, which we see all the time in wrestling these days, but in this match, it worked. I thought it was very effective. Aries kicked out of Sonata's Tiger Suplex, which nobody else has so far, which is why I think this works so well, because these are two guys who rarely, if ever, do you see them executing their finish and people kick out. And that's probably why it works so well here. It was the first time he has done the Tiger Suplex, I think, and somebody kicked out of it. Sanada immediately went to the top rope to try his other big move, which is the moonsault, nailed it, and he kicked out of that too. And at that point, Sanada was just out of his mind, didn't know what to do. He went for a second moonsault, Aries rolled out of the way, discus forearm, drop kick in the corner, into the brainbuster, but Sanada kicked out. And this was great, because after the brainbuster failed, which never happens in Aries matches, he immediately went to the top rope for the 450 splash and got the win. Aries does not use the 450 splash much anymore. He really relies on the brainbuster as his finish. So him busting that move out and winning with it made it feel special. You know, like it was his secret weapon that he used out of desperation because the title meant so much to him. Match lived up to expectations. Of course, these things can always go a little bit longer. TNA doesn't really do very well. Not even as well as WWE, because, you know, at least on Raw, when we have like a big-time match, sometimes they will give that match a long time if it needs it. They'll give matches 15 minutes, 20 minutes. I mean, look at all those Shield six-man tags on that show, that headline that went 20, 23 minutes. You never see a match go that long on Impact. It is a shorter show. Raw has an extra hour, but there's no reason you can't have a big-time match that goes 15, 17 minutes. You know, I'd like to see them do that more often. This thing went less than 10. I think it went like 8.5 minutes. But it was still very good. Best thing on the entire show. Bully Ray came out, very pissed off at Rhino, wanted to confront him in the ring. Rhino came out. He accused Bully of being a con man. Is Rhino new to the wrestling business? Has he never encountered a wrestling promoter before? Just asking. He said Bully used people just to further his own career. Again, I ask, is this guy new to the wrestling business? He said he used his partner Devon, just like he used Paul E. Heyman. That's what he called him. Just like he used Delusional Dixie. Bully said it was Rhino's own fault he got fired from WWE and then got fired from TNA. They just can't help themselves with the WWE references. They were doing good for a while. It's been a while since we've heard those initials uttered on Impact. And sure enough, they had to mention him. You know, there needs to be a moratorium on WWE mentions on this show for at least 5 years. If TNA lasts that long and is still around in 5 years, there needs to be no mention of those three initials at all. Just as of right now, as of this moment, that's it. Stop. No more. Bully said Rhino was once hardcore, now he's a bitch. EC3 spoke up, and when Bully threatened him, Rhino gored Bully Ray. They put the boots to him until Tommy Dreamer ran in with a kendo stick, chased off the bad guys, made the save. I'm okay with this only because I know that in a few weeks, Dreamer's going to be gone, his story will be over, and we don't have to deal with the old ECW guys anymore. Gail Kim pinned Angelina Love with Eat Defeat, four-way match for the women's, or I should say the Knockouts Championship, also included Madison Rayne and Brittany. So Gail Kim retains the title. Finishing sequence was good. They had each girl hit her finish until Gail hit hers and got the pin. Other than that, wasn't anything special for a major title match. You got four women in there. It was over in 5 minutes. Brittany's getting better. She's not, you know, what I would say great, but she is improving. And so Gail is still the champion. We got a Lashley workout video. This is before the main event. Main event was a battle royal for a shot at Lashley's title. And we had a workout video with MVP at the gym with Lashley. Lashley takes the belt everywhere he goes. So every shot of Lashley working on a machine, running on the treadmill, there you see the title is hanging there in the background. And MVP is talking. He's almost like Lashley's spokesperson, which is great, because Lashley should not be his own spokesperson for the same reasons Brock Lesnar should not be his own spokesperson. It kills the illusion. Lashley needs to just not speak. He needs to come out there or stand in the background of these promos and just look mean and big and nasty and strong and not say a word. So MVP, I thought this was the perfect role for him. I thought this video was very well done. It really got Lashley over as a monster. MVP, I think, has been great in the role of manager for Lashley while he rehabs that knee injury. Much, much better than he was in the director of operations role, where he just became overbearing. I would not mind him staying in the role of manager for a while, even after his leg heals up. I can't say that I'm dying to see MVP get back in the ring like he's some kind of dazzling, you know, in-ring performer. I think this role works for him right now, and just put all your effort towards getting Lashley over as that big monster heel champion. Main event was a 20-man over-the-top rope battle royal. The winner goes to New York City next week to wrestle Lashley for the championship on Impact. As battle royals go, I thought it was good. You know, it was decent to good. Came down to two baby faces, Eric Young and Jeff Hardy. Hardy got the win. He was interviewed in the ring by Jeremy Borash afterwards about the match next week. Lashley came out. The two of them had a face-off. Lashley raised the belt in the air. And that's how they went off the air. So, to recap, we had no Dixie Carter, no Sam Shaw, the apparent end of Willow, at least for now, an excellent match between Aries and Sonata, and a halfway decent battle royal with good hype for next week's main event in New York City. They ended the show with the face-off with Lashley and Hardy in the ring instead of cutting to the back one last time and ending with Dixie Carter talking, MVP talking. And guess what? It was effective. That's exactly how they should have gone off the air. Good cliffhanger for next week. And next week, it's the return of Six Sides and the first of many, many, many tapings in New York City. I don't think that the taping I went to airs for, probably another month. I'm guessing it's going to be 3 weeks, maybe four, before the shows with me and Brian Blade start airing. But I thought overall this was a good show. This was a good episode of Impact. They're on kind of a roll lately. They haven't had that one big blowaway show, but they've been good. That's all I ask. As horrendous as Impact was in the month of May into like the first half of June, before they took the show back on the road to Pennsylvania, I'll take a good show over what they were giving us before. And I think some of the New York City shows have the potential to be that blowaway show. So we'll see. I think the show might get even better in the weeks ahead, and especially when they give us the payoff to certain angles. So yeah, no Dixie. Good show. Thumbs up. Let's hope they keep up the momentum. Let's move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster at gmail.com. You could send MP3 audio questions as well. Please try to keep them to around 30 seconds or less, or else they're probably not going to be used. And always include your name and where you are from. We have an audio question this week. It is from a familiar voice who happened to be halfway around the world at the time he recorded this.
Yo, Slobber Monster, it's me, Noah Mark, live from Beijing, China. That's right, I'm here in Beijing, China. I was just in Tokyo, Japan, and I missed the WWE by a week, but these things happen. And while I was in Hong Kong, I stopped by your favorite fried chicken place and grabbed myself a leg in your honor at the Hong Kong International Airport. I stopped by Popeyes. Anyway, I thought I'd drop you a line. Considering I'm here in Beijing, China, and we just had Kenta signed to NXT, I'm wondering who your top three NXT guys are that you would like to see move on to the main roster.
Not since Godzilla has there been something as terrifying to hit that part of the world as Noah Mark. Three guys from NXT who I would like to see on the main roster. I mean, there's more than three, but if I had to pick three realistically, in no particular order, Sami Zayn, I think, is a given. I mean, they love this guy. Triple H even has made comments about him. And when they did that last conference call before the last NXT special, I think somebody even asked him, like, if you had to pick one NXT guy to work with, who would be the guy that you would want to work with? They kind of put him on the spot. And Triple H said Sami Zayn. Like, they love him. They know that they could put him in there with almost anybody. He'll have good matches. He's very reliable. He gets it. He knows what he's doing in there. And the fans love him. He's got that lovable kind of underdog personality. He's not the biggest guy in the world. But, you know, when his matches get going, people are always into it. They're into the near falls. They're into everything. I have no concerns at all about Sami Zayn's ability to get over on the main roster. It really just boils down, as it does with everybody, to how hard they push him. Do they look at him? Does Vince look at him when he gets a good look at him on Raw and on SmackDown and say, you know, goddamn, he's small, you know, and then he gets pigeonholed into that spot. Does Triple H push for him, you know, because he's one of Triple H's guys? I don't know. That'll be the story, I guess, that plays itself out once he makes his way up. But I am very eager to see him on the main roster, having matches with guys like Cesaro, who he's worked with before, and maybe eventually Daniel Bryan if he ever makes his way back, and the Shield guys like Rollins and Ambrose. So Sami Zayn would be at the top of my list. Tyler Breeze is another one. I'm okay if they keep him down on NXT for a while longer, but I think he could come up to the main roster next week and can get that character over. I don't think people give him enough credit for being a good wrestler. You know, he's got a good background. You know, Lance Storm was his trainer. He's no dummy. He knows what he's doing in that ring. He plays his character perfectly. He's just so, you know, hateable. I mean, people will, you know, say they love the character. I'm a big fan of the Tyler Breeze character, but he's also very hateable, I think, in that role. And I think it's the kind of character that if you've never seen Tyler Breeze before, when you see the character and you see the entrance and the music and the stuff where he holds the phone up and takes selfies all the time, you'll think to yourself, oh, what a stupid gimmick. The guy is just a gimmick. But when he's in there with somebody, you know, good, and gets going, and starts actually wrestling, you realize, huh, okay, well, this guy can actually wrestle, so maybe he's not half bad. That was kind of how I grew to like the character, and I'm a big fan of it. So I think Tyler Breeze would be on my list. He's a personal favorite of mine. And if I had to pick a third act, it would be two people. I'm going to cheat a little bit here. And I'm going to say Colin Cassidy and Enzo Amore. I really like their shtick. I like the combination of Enzo on the microphone doing his thing. If he's going to make money, I think, in WWE, he's going to make money with his mouth. He's going to make money on the mic as probably a manager, in all honesty, for Colin Cassidy. Colin Cassidy is this nearly 7 foot tall, kind of skinny, lanky guy who has also embraced the character. He's got that thick Jersey accent. Used to play basketball at NYU. Little fact there for you. I know somebody who actually played on the basketball team with him. And he has come into his own in that character. Enzo broke his leg. He was out for 6 months. So Colin Cassidy was a man without really anything going on. But I think what happened is in those 5-6 months that Enzo was gone, it kind of forced him to talk more for himself. So he's actually developed into a good talker. Not as good as Enzo, but he can certainly speak. It's not like he can't cut a promo. And I think in the ring, he's also improved, and he's got his big moves, you know, the the Empire. Oh God, I forgot what he calls him now, but he's got that slam into the standing elbow drop. He's good, but together they're at their best. And God knows WWE needs more tag teams right now. You've got Stardust, you've got Rybacksel, you've got the Usos and the Wyatts, and then after that, you know, who else is there? I'm sure I must be forgetting one, but the point is they can use more tag teams. I would bring them up as a tag team. Eventually you can break them up, and maybe Colin gets over as a 7-foot singles. I hate to think that they would break them up right away or bring one or the other to the main roster without their partner. I think they should come up as a team. I think they could come up as a team right now and get over very well as big baby faces on the roster. So that would be my top three. You know, Prince Devitt has not yet signed. They're probably going to make that announcement at the end of the month, beginning of August. Kevin Steen also has not either not signed, or he may have signed, but they haven't made any sort of announcement about him either. And as far as Kenta goes, if anybody's thinking, oh, why wouldn't you mention Kenta? WWE has yet to show me they know what to do with any Japanese talent, any sort of Asian talent. So I would rather he stay on NXT for a while and mix it up with those other guys when they come in, like Steen, like Devitt, like Zayn, like Neville. I have no problem with them keeping him on NXT for, you know, a few months before they consider bringing him up to the main roster. And until they show me, as a fan, that they know how to use a guy like him, excuse me for not having a whole lot of faith that if they send Kenta right to the main roster, he's going to be anything other than a comedy character. I'm in no rush to see him on Raw or SmackDown. This comes from Thought in Melbourne, Australia. Why not have the Intercontinental Championship match main event Battleground? They should make two number one contender matches with each winner advancing to the pay-per-view. The final match should be Dean Ambrose versus Seth Rollins, and the Authority can brag leading up to the event, saying that Seth is going to become a Triple Crown champion. They go out and have a 25-minute classic where the outcome can go either way. Everyone knows Cena is going to win the Fatal 4-Way, so why not let the Intercontinental title headline a meaningless B pay-per-view? This Battle Royal idea sucks. WWE has given us no reason to care about this. Well, I can't argue with that last point. Headlining the pay-per-view is not going to happen. And I wouldn't do it either. You have to build to that. You can't just say, well, this pay-per-view means nothing. It's Battleground. It's a B show. So we'll headline with the IC title. You can't just do that. If you're going to actually do that, if your goal is to eventually have pay-per-views, B shows that will be headlined by an Intercontinental title match, you've got to make that title mean something. You've got to put it on somebody who is not just a mid-card guy. You have to have somebody like a Seth Rollins or a Dean Ambrose actually be the Intercontinental Champion. Guys that maybe aren't quite main event yet, maybe they kind of are, but they're like upper mid-card main event, but they're at a high enough level where maybe they could help by going out there and having really kick-ass matches for the Intercontinental Championship. And over a period of time, if IC title matches were to start headlining SmackDown, and if IC title matches every now and then were to headline Raw, people might buy into it a little bit more, the idea that a match like that could actually headline a pay-per-view, but that's going to take a while. I mean, you can't just snap your fingers and say, you know what, I want that title to mean something, so why don't we just put that on last on the pay-per-view? You can't do that. And frankly, I don't even know that I would want to do that, because you've got one world champion now. The biggest title in that company is the WWE title. So that match should headline the show. It doesn't matter whether you think the outcome is predictable or not. That's the number one title in the company. Until it isn't, it should headline those shows. James from Staten Island, New York, wants to talk about The Undertaker's present state and dwindling future. He says, if Undertaker does not come back for another match, he should be inducted into the Hall of Fame sooner rather than later. I'm sure Rock won't mind waiting another year if that's the case. And if Undertaker does come back, how does he go after anyone other than Brock Lesnar? Brock did break the streak, terrible as it was. And the only way I see Taker being able to wrestle one last match is avenging the loss of his vaunted streak and possibly having a better match victoriously against Brock, rather than a throwaway match with Sting, who wrestles in a t-shirt. And by defeating Brock after losing at WrestleMania 30, Undertaker will prove, which he really doesn't have to, that he is so much more than the streak to this generation of fans. What would you do? I would not do a rematch between Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, I can tell you that much. Part of it is because their first match was no good, but that's not the main reason. The main reason is you don't have to rematch everybody. You know, like if a babyface loses a match, it's okay not to rematch them and do the whole even Steven deal. In a way, I kind of like the fact that The Undertaker, you know, lost to Brock, and Brock went over on him. He was the stronger guy. He's younger, he's stronger, he's bigger, he's faster. Physically, right now, today, he's better in every conceivable way than The Undertaker is. The Undertaker, I would say The Undertaker is now starting to show his age. Realistically, he's been showing his age now for a few years. He looked particularly old this year. And so that's why I think there's at least a chance he has wrestled his last match. I'm with you. Actually, I don't know if you actually believe this or not, but I think Undertaker has not wrestled his last match. If he does come back and they do the match with Sting, fine. I think it's a big attraction. I have no problem with that. Or you can put him in the ring with somebody else, but I would not put him in there with Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar beat him. Brock Lesnar now is being, I hope, being groomed, even if just for a few months, to be the champion, although I would, you know, do it for longer. But again, you have that issue of you can't have a world champion that doesn't defend hardly at all and doesn't defend at any house shows for 9 months. You know, 2 months, 3 months, that's one thing. I was an advocate for keeping the belt on Daniel Bryan when I thought he might be back by or before SummerSlam. Now, of course, who even knows if he's going to come back at all. If Brock wins the title at SummerSlam, and he's got one more match that he's under contract for this year, the following month at Night of Champions, which is why I think I could see him winning it and then dropping it right back to Cena in a rematch the month after, which I think would be a big mistake. But unless you can get him in for more dates, how realistic that is, I don't know. So however they handle it, the point is, champion or no champion, Brock has to be kept practically unbeaten and kept strong through WrestleMania next year. If the idea is just to come back at WrestleMania next year to have Undertaker get his win back, I'm not a fan of that idea because I can't buy it, especially after the match they had this year. I just don't buy it. And I know Brock is only under contract until WrestleMania 31. It is possible whatever match he has at WrestleMania next year could be his last, or he may sign a new deal and extend it for another year or two after that. But he is only under contract until Mania next year. That could be his last match. So whoever Brock wrestles, he should lose. Brock Lesnar should lose, but not until WrestleMania next year. And the person that Brock Lesnar should lose to is a guy like a Roman Reigns. Somebody like that. That's a fresh match we haven't seen before. Reigns is going to be the future of this company. He's another big guy. He's not going to back down from Brock. He's not smaller than Brock. You know, I mean, maybe in some ways he is, but more or less they're about the same size. They're two big dudes that would beat you up. That's the kind of match I think that they should be looking to book for WrestleMania next year. And that's the kind of person that Brock should be losing to. Not the 50-something-year-old or 50-year-old, maybe at that point, Undertaker, who looks every bit of 75. So, you know, the fact that he lost to Brock doesn't kill his legacy or anything like that. I don't see why he has to come back and get that win back. He has to avenge that win. Brock broke the streak. He should bow his head in respect, shake the guy's hand, and if he's going to come back for another match, it should be a special attraction. And maybe it's against Sting. Maybe it's against another big star. But I would not book him against Brock Lesnar. I have no interest in seeing that rematch. James is also very upset over how the Bray Wyatt-John Cena feud played out. So I'll share this with you. He says, that feud should have been the defining moment for Bray Wyatt, and in the end, it wasn't. I totally understand that WWE is a business and they need to make money. That's all well and good, but please explain to me how it is possible for them to continue to protect the face of their company at the expense of the future. Bray Wyatt is without question the best character and promo in WWE today, and by winning a feud, not just a bullshit match over John Cena, it would have launched him into the main event scene. Instead, WWE played it safe, had Cena overcome the odds, and had him beat up an up-and-coming star. Yet, I'm supposed to feel excited because Jericho is back to do the job that John Cena did not do. Don't get me wrong, I don't think for a second John Cena made the call himself to win, but I seriously doubt he's put his foot down about helping the young guy succeed by beating him. Sandow, Wyatt, and you'll soon see Rusev added to that list. It tells me that 10 years later, if WWE still feels they must protect their top guy, then they've selected the wrong guy. When a guy is as good as Wyatt, he shouldn't be beaten like that and then have everyone scratching their head saying, how come he doesn't seem special anymore? At least when Hogan beat Undertaker back in the day when he first won the title, they made it look as if Hogan had pulled a fast one on him. Well, it didn't look like he pulled a fast one. He blatantly threw ashes in the guy's eyes, so let's just clear that up. But anyway, he says, and protected Undertaker from looking weak. Here, they took no such precaution with Bray Wyatt, and that is one of the many reasons why there is a level of resentment towards the leader of the C-Nation. That is true. You can tack that on to the question I answered last week about why people hate John Cena. That's part of it, too. There is a resentment from people who think it's all Cena's fault, like he's booking the product. But it's all Cena's fault. He ends up in these feuds with these guys. Even if they win a match, it's a fluky win. But in the end, Cena gets his hand raised. And the guy is no better off for it. There is some truth to that. It has happened. Look at Dolph Ziggler. What good did it do him? I don't for a second think that Bray Wyatt is going to suffer the same fate as Dolph Ziggler. I think Bray Wyatt will be champion one day. He'll be over big time more as a babyface than a heel. Look, I've said this before, and my mind hasn't changed. The two big stars, kind of like what Rock Austin was to a previous era of Cena, and you could say Cena Orton or even Cena Punk maybe to the current era, I think Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt are that to the next era coming up. Probably both as babyfaces, although, again, Wyatt is such a great heel, he can be either one. But I'm not concerned about him, despite the fact that he lost. I wouldn't have necessarily done that either. But he'll be okay. It's all those other guys that you can point to who never really recovered from that. And, you know, look, I understand the frustration. You are not alone. There are a lot of people who feel the way that you do. And we'll see, you know, with Jericho now. Look, Jericho's going to have to win a match. Jericho can't just come in and have 2-3 matches with Bray Wyatt, lose all of them. He's got to look competitive in some way. He might even win at Battleground. I don't think it's a slam dunk guarantee that Bray Wyatt's going to beat Chris Jericho at Battleground. I'm almost sure they're going to have a rematch at SummerSlam. So Jericho maybe wins the first match, and Wyatt comes back and decisively wins the second match. I could see that. I could see that happening. But in the end, like James said, the outcome will be very different than the outcome of the Cena feud in that there is no way this feud ends without Chris Jericho putting over Bray Wyatt. And that's what he needs right now. He doesn't have a whole lot of direction coming out of that Money in the Bank match. He didn't win the title. You know, even Harper and Rowan didn't win belts. They were losers. The entire Wyatt family came out of Money in the Bank losers. So Wyatt needs something now to kind of regain some of that momentum that he did lose from the Cena feud. This question comes from Matt, who says he is a gay wrestling fan and loves John Cena the way that lots of other male wrestling fans love the Divas. He says, if Cena was gay, do you think he would be WWE's number one guy? Do you also reckon Roman Reigns would still get pushed to become the next big star if he suddenly came out as gay right now? Good question. I have not thought about that, but I think with Cena, I mean, it depends. You know, if he was to make that proclamation in the middle of his run, it doesn't change a thing. He's still the top guy. They continue to push him that way, and it's a non-issue. If it comes out or he makes an announcement in 03-04, or let's say even 04-05, right before he got that big push in that first title, I think back then, honestly, I think it could have had an effect. And not necessarily because WWE would be afraid to have an openly gay world champion. I think back then, their big concern might have been, how are people going to perceive this? We can't put this guy in that position because it's never going to work. People's attitudes back then, and we're going back 9-10 years now, were even then very different than they are today. And, you know, truth be told, if you look at the makeup of wrestling fans and where they come from, probably many wrestling fans come from the South or grew up in the South. A lot of Southern wrestling fans out there. And the mentality down there is or was very different than it would be, let's say, in the Northeast or in other parts of the world. So I do think that if John Cena had come out of the closet before he got that first big push as a world champion in 2005, I don't know that he would be the star he is now because I don't think they would have pushed him that way. I think it would have had an effect on how hard they pushed him. Now, if Roman Reigns tomorrow was to come out and say the same thing, and make, which I'm sure would be a big surprise to his wife and daughter, but if he did, I don't think it changes anything. That's the difference between the way things were then and the way things are now. It's just this feeling I have that I don't think it would matter at all. And if anything, I think WWE would probably exploit it and want to get a lot of publicity out of it. I think they would love that aspect of it. But there is something else to consider here, and that is that for years and years and years in wrestling, you had the hot babyface who was hot in that he was over with the crowd, and maybe he was a good-looking guy. Even if he was married or if he was in a relationship, if he had a family, if he had a kid, you never mentioned that because you always wanted the fans, the female fans, right, to think that this guy was available. There was just something like mentally about it where if they found out he was married, they wouldn't be into him as much. So like Ricky Steamboat was this great-looking baby face who came up in the 70s and then into the 80s, and you know, it was never really focused on that, you know, he was a married guy, and I mean, later on, he did bring out the little dragon, right, his kid, out for WrestleMania 4, so they actually did acknowledge it, but that was later on, and at that point, he was kind of out of favor with WWE. They weren't looking at him as being their next big babyface star. But, you know, they never talked about Hulk Hogan on TV and his family and his kids. You know, the Von Erichs, back at their peak in the early 80s down in World Class, they were as hot as any act in the history of wrestling when it came to hot babyfaces. People loved them. Women. I mean, they would riot for these guys when they would come out. I'm not sure if any of them back during that peak were already married or had a kid. I mean, maybe one of them did. I don't know. But if they did, it never would have been mentioned on TV. They wouldn't have said, oh, you know, here comes Mike Von Erich, and you know, he's a married man and has a kid. Like, no, the appeal for them was they were these like hot young guys that all the girls were into. And that's what they wanted to push. That's what they were selling it on. That was a big part of why those guys were so popular. Maybe not with the guys. They probably just liked them because the Von Erich family was big down there in Texas. But that's what you got a lot back in the day. They banked on that. And you wouldn't want to stress the fact that this guy had a wife. Certainly not, you know, if he was gay. And I'm sure, believe me, there were plenty of gay wrestlers back in the day that just never came out and we never knew about. And I'll use, you know, Pat Patterson as an example here of a guy who was gay, is gay, and people knew it. People in the wrestling business knew it going back to the 60s and the 70s. This was not a big secret. You know, the whole reveal they just did on Legends House, that was more, I guess, his coming out in public. Thankfully, they didn't try to, you know, pretend like nobody knew and it was this big shocking thing, because it wasn't. You know, Patterson's been out for probably a good 40 years, maybe more. But he got over just fine. Everywhere he went, he was a star. And he went to work for Vince McMahon, didn't change anything. He was a big star, transitioned into a role as an announcer, and he became one of Vince's right-hand men behind the scenes. To this day, he still has a role in the company. One of their most celebrated superstars. So him being gay didn't affect it at all, which is rare. I'm not exactly sure why it didn't affect him the way that it affected other people, or it probably would have affected other people, but it didn't. He was one of the few that got off unscathed, and he was a big star everywhere he went. There was never any fuss that I can recall reading about or hearing about from any of the wrestlers in terms of working with him, and they knew. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm not going to work with him, you know. I never heard any stories like that. Seemed like everybody loved working with Pat Patterson, probably because he was such a big star, and they knew working with him, they'd make a lot of money. So with him, it was never an issue. But the whole babyface thing and kind of keeping their relationship status or sex status a secret, I think those things now are less of an issue. They openly acknowledge these guys are married or have girlfriends. I think Total Divas probably has a lot to do with that. So everybody now knows Daniel Bryan's a married man. John Cena is with Nikki Bella. You know, the Uso guy, Jimmy Uso, was with Trinity, and things are a lot more open now than they were back in the day. But I really do think that if that had been revealed right before John Cena got that big, big push that he got, it probably would have had an effect on it, and, you know, probably because WWE would have been afraid at how he would have gotten over. You know, can this guy really be the face of our company if he's an openly gay wrestler? And I don't know that he would have been anywhere near the big star he is today. Joseph from Connecticut. When people ask me who's the greatest WWE performer of all time, I say Shawn Michaels. But most people in wrestling say Ric Flair. To me, though, HBK is the greatest because of his showmanship and high flying. Can you recommend any Flair matches that might make me believe in why people consider him to be the best? I addressed this recently when someone wrote in about how disrespectful it was for Flair to be left out of that opening segment at WrestleMania this year with Hogan, Rock, and Austin. And I said, Flair was never a top guy in WWE like those guys were at their level. You know, it was a segment honoring the top stars in WWE history. So if we're talking the greatest WWE performer of all time, Flair isn't even in the conversation when it comes to top three or top five. I'd put Shawn ahead of him, Bret, Undertaker, Austin, all those guys. But if we're talking greatest of all time in all of wrestling, then yes, Flair would be considered, rightly, by many to be the best or one of the best of all time. His body of work was a lot stronger in the 80s in the NWA than it was in WWE. And that was at a time when the travel was far more brutal. As NWA champion, back when NWA actually still meant something, Flair would be sent from territory to territory, you know, to defend the title. He worked everywhere, Japan. And a lot of times he would wrestle 60-minute marathon matches, and he can make someone who is marginally good look like the second coming of Lou Thesz or Frank Gotch. You know, Flair was never a flashy guy like Shawn Michaels, but he can make his opponents look like they were on his level, even if they weren't. And when he was in there with a guy who was on his level, like a Dusty Rhodes or a Terry Funk, it was magic. You throw in his promos, and the guy was untouchable back in the day. Find me a more complete pro wrestler between the promo skills and the in-ring ability that he had than Ric Flair. You can't do it. He could be a great babyface. He was an even better heel, which is always the role he preferred. Still does to this day. He could do it all. So I would recommend you go back and watch the three matches he had with Ricky Steamboat in 1989. That should be required viewing for any wrestling fan. Probably the most famous series of matches in wrestling history, at least in this country. Really, any of his work from the NWA, I would say in the mid to late 80s, early 90s, his matches with Dusty, his matches with Terry Funk, especially the I Quit match at Clash of the Champions 9. They've got the entire catalog of clashes up on the video on demand section on the WWE Network, so you can go watch it when you're done listening to this podcast. The match with Sting at the very first Clash that put Sting on the map as a main event player in WCW. Their Great American Bash 1990 match where Sting finally won the belt. His match with Vader at Starrcade 93, which was a retirement match, which is funny. But the way that was built up and the match itself, and I think they were actually in the Carolinas, which is Flair country, and he won the belt, and it was this great thing. The matches he had with Barry Windham, when it looked like Windham was the next big breakout star, yeah, it didn't quite work out that way, but they had some hour-long matches that were great. I think one of them is actually on one of Flair's DVDs that came out many years ago. Don't let the later years of his career, when the NWO was beating him up every week on TV and he was committed to a mental asylum, and even the stuff he did in WWE when he was already pretty washed up, don't let that stuff cloud your judgment of the guy as a wrestler, because in his prime, Flair was the man inside that ring. This comes from Chad. Has there ever been a wrestler whose match quality dropped as drastically as Scott Steiner's did over a 10-year period? He went from being one of the best wrestlers of the early 90s to that debacle of a match he had with Triple H at the Royal Rumble in 2003. Well, that was a combination of injuries and him just bulking up to ridiculous proportions. However he got that way, he was just gigantic. Just muscles coming out of muscles. I don't even know why you would want to look like that. I guess it's a personal preference, but it really hampered his in-ring ability. And he could still go out there and have good matches. And I remember the later years in TNA. So you're talking about that Rumble match with Triple H in 03. Fast forward to his days in TNA. I don't even know what year it would have been. Probably 08, 09, 2010. He had like a mission. he was like a man on a mission with something to prove, because there was a period where he went out there and started having these really good matches, and he was busting out Frankensteiners, which I hadn't seen him do in years. So he still had the ability, like it was still in him to go out there and have that kind of a match, but he couldn't. You know, again, he was older, he was more broken down, the injuries, and again, his size. He was always a big guy. Scott Steiner in 1991 was a big guy, but he was nowhere near as big as Scott Steiner in 1998. I mean, not even close. Not as agile, not as quick. So, I mean, that's really why it happened. And yeah, it was a pretty rapid descent from where he had been to where he would end up. Funny thing about that, though, you say in the early 90s, he was one of the best wrestlers, right? That's what you just said. And fast forward to his later years, and he was all broken down and shit. You fast forward to the later years of WCW when he was already breaking down, and he never won a world title until then. It wasn't until he bulked up and looked the way that he looked and cut the promos that he would cut, which were debatable whether they were awful or fantastic, wasn't until then that he got a world championship. What does that say about wrestling? It's not very good. But that's what happened. I'll tell you this. I can't think of another name who fell as quickly, but I will say this. On the flip side, I would submit to you the case of The Undertaker as the polar opposite. I can't think of a guy, especially a guy at his level, like a main event top shelf guy in a major promotion, who went from having such horrendous matches in the early part of his career to having the best matches of his career in his 40s, when he was already mostly broken down. You look at some of the best matches Undertaker had, it was those WrestleMania matches with Shawn Michaels, the matches with Triple H, the match with Batista, the match with Orton, the match with Punk. And a lot of that had to do with his opponent helping to, you know, carry him through it. Punk, I think, deserves a lot of credit for that at 29. Compare that to the early WrestleMania matches he had. Compare that to a lot of the early pay-per-view matches he had, and Undertaker versus Undertaker, and Undertaker versus Kama, and King Kong Bundy, and IRS, and Yokozuna, and Mabel. A lot of it had to do with his opponents, but, you know, even back then, the Undertaker character never really did much other than chop and choke. That's what it was. It was chop and choke. It was the chop and choke era of the Undertaker. That's all we ever got. But then the character evolved. He got better opponents, more talented opponents. You know, even the Big Evil days, he had that ladder match on Raw with Jeff Hardy. He had the best matches of his career in the second part, or even the final act of his career. They just got better and better and better. I mean, there were people in 1998, you know, who would say, and this was in the dirt sheets and everything back then, that Undertaker was told his time was coming to a close. He needed surgery. He needed to have his hip replaced. He had terrible knees. That was in 98. And then think about the match he had in 2009, over a decade later, with Shawn Michaels. It's amazing. I cannot think of another guy in his position who had such shit matches early on and went on to have such awesome matches. You know, that No Way Out match with Kurt Angle for the world title. Just great stuff. They could do a whole DVD just based on the second part of Undertaker's career. Kent from Philadelphia. Everybody talks about dream matches that could have happened but didn't for whatever reason, yet nobody ever talks about mid-card dream matches that could have happened. A few might include Chris Jericho against Jeff Jarrett in WWF, Chris Benoit versus Bill Goldberg in WCW, and Steve Austin versus Razor Ramon in WWF. What would be some of yours? Well, first of all, Jeff Jarrett would not be in any wrestling dream match of mine, mid-card or otherwise. Let's just state that first. I always thought Ken Shamrock and Kurt Angle in a Battle of the Ankle Locks would have been a natural match. That would have been near the top of my list. You could do Jack Swagger and Kurt Angle today if they re-sign Angle. You know, his contract is up September 21st. That's what he said on Jim Ross's podcast. And clearly, he is angling to come back to WWE for one last contract. I don't know that they want him back. So he may end up back in TNA, and that match may never happen. But that would be, you know, Angle and Swagger would seem to me to be a natural match. Although I don't think I would call that a dream match, so I guess that doesn't really apply to what you're saying. I don't know about other mid-card matches. You know, when you think of a dream match, you think about it in the context of a big-time match. That's almost always going to include main event guys. A dream mid-card match is like thinking back to all the hot girls in school that, you know, you would have loved to have hooked up with, and then being like, man, I remember, you know, Becky. She was okay. She was all right. Not really that attractive, but man, if only I could go back and hook up with her. Doesn't make any sense. Nobody in their right mind would ever say that. So, you know, why would you even think that? A dream match should be a big-time match with big-time stars. Otherwise, it's just a match. Nissim Levy, I greatly enjoyed the Hardy Brothers tag team work back when they were in WWE. As single stars, I found Jeff Hardy very exciting in the ring, but Matt Hardy did not impress me. My question is this. Do you think Matt Hardy would have amounted to much without Jeff Hardy? He would not have been a star in WWE without Jeff. I don't think. No, I don't think so. They got over as a tag team. They got over largely because Jeff was a crazy man. Still is. Wait until you see that Swanton spot in that match with Lashley on Impact this week. And, you know, Jeff took a lot of spectacular bumps. Still does. That got them noticed. I think Jeff on his own would have had a shot, but Matt, you know, Matt never had the flash that his brother had. He's a smart guy. You know, you listen to people who know Matt talk about his mind for wrestling going back to the Omega days, and he didn't just wrestle. He would book. He would handle all these different things. You know, I could see Matt Hardy as being a good promoter one day. You know, he's a smart guy, even though he's done a lot of stupid things. Jeff was always the free spirit, you know, very laid back, making his music and poems and motocross and all that shit that he would love doing on the side. But no, I mean, I don't think Hardy would have become as big of a star without Jeff. Not at all. Lastly here, Brian Mahoney in Longmont, Colorado. I was just looking at random opinions on YouTube concerning pro wrestling and came across an interesting point that I've thought about, and I'm having a difficult time arguing against. In your opinion, is Raven perhaps the greatest independent wrestler of all time? The Undertaker of the Indies, if you will. And do you think, especially with the recent success of Bray Wyatt, in this generation, that Raven is the biggest missed opportunity out of the hundreds in WWE history? Well, no, I don't believe that for a second. I think Raven could have been a lot bigger than he was, absolutely. Is he the biggest missed opportunity of all the guys that they have fucked up and the guys that they passed on? Raven is the biggest missed opportunity? No. No, not even close. Is he the best independent wrestler of all time? I mean, I don't know. I mean, what does that mean? The character was awesome. His in-ring work was nothing special. I never looked at Raven as being this fantastic professional wrestler. He came up with, or I think he came up with, maybe Heyman did, but he came up with the character, which was a big departure from that Johnny Polo character he was in WWE, and he made it work. And at that time, I think that character maybe fit the mindset. Maybe in that grunge era it worked, and it wouldn't work so well today. You know, it's hard to say. I think for that time, the character worked, and he was a genius for making it work the way he did. But, I mean, greatest indie wrestler of all time, what does that even mean? There's a lot of really great guys out there who wrestle on the indies who are a hell of a lot better in the ring than Raven. So are we talking in ring? Are we talking character? As a character, yeah, he might be. He might be the greatest developed character in the history of, you say indie wrestling, I assume you're not counting ECW as, you know, a big-time promotion. I think a lot of people would disagree. I would disagree. They had TV. They were on pay-per-view. That makes them not an indie. But the greatest missed opportunity that WWE ever had, that's a big stretch. I would not say that at all. Missed opportunity, yeah, but not the biggest. Before we wrap up this week, we have one more segment. And this is a Retro Raw review that I'm doing here from July 13th, 1998. Today, as I record the show, is July 13th. It was 16 years ago this week that Raw emanated from the Continental Airlines Arena in East Rutherford, New Jersey, now the Izod Center, which became famous the night after last year's WrestleMania. And I attended my very first live Raw show on that night. What happened was I won tickets from a local radio station. It was one of those call-in things, be caller number or whatever, and you'll win tickets. Somehow I won. Not only did I win, but I actually went on to win tickets the same way from that radio station 7 more times. How I did that, I have no idea. Especially back then, wrestling was hot. Believe me, there were a lot of people calling that radio station wanting those tickets. I won them. It was 4 seats. Went with my family. I took a friend with me. And so we went to the arena. We were the first ones up in the luxury box because they were luxury box seats. I think I've mentioned this before. So this was my first time setting foot in a luxury box. I'm like a kid in a candy store. They have food, free food, just lay in there. Take what you want, soda. I run to the front. Thankfully, we got there first. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is be in the last row. There's only like 5 rows, maybe 3 rows, but you don't want to be in the last row of the luxury box because then you're not going to see shit. So we took seats in the front row of the luxury box, which was, I would say, maybe midway up. I know some arenas have luxury boxes like all the way up. This wasn't all the way up. This was like mid-level maybe. Not anywhere near the ring, but we had a good view. And, you know, we're sitting in a freaking luxury box. The window is open, you know, because you can close it. I don't know why you would want to. And I'm ready. I'm stoked, man, for this show. And then they had a pre-show meet and greet where they were going to have 4 wrestlers come into the luxury box and meet with you and take pictures and sign autographs. So the 4 people they sent in for our meet and greet were Mick Foley, Mankind, but he didn't have the mask on. And this was only about like 2 weeks maybe after the Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker. So you can imagine how this guy was feeling. I mean, he looked like he was completely wrecked. He looked like he was in a car crash, which, you know, he really was in a lot of ways. So he looked a little worse for wear. We had Owen Hart. We had Mark Henry. And I think Henry and Owen, I think at the time, were both part of the Nation. And Luna Vachon. And unfortunately, 2 of the 4 are no longer alive. All of them were just, they couldn't be nicer. Mark Henry was nice. Luna was really nice. I had met her previously at the first Fan Fest back during the WrestleMania 10. Owen, I've talked about Owen. You know, I met him. He was the nicest of the bunch. And when everybody was done signing and taking pictures and they filed out because they had to go from one box to the next, Owen stopped, turned around. Nobody was paying attention to what he was saying because everyone was buzzing. They were showing each other their autographs and stuff. And I happened to be watching him and he was just like, does anybody else want pictures? Anybody? I spoke up, got a picture with him, which turned out to be the picture I used in the newspaper column that I did less than a year later when he died. So that photo has special meaning for me. So all of that occurred before the show. And then the show itself began. So I thought it would be fun now to go back on this anniversary, 16 years later, take a look at a classic Attitude Era episode of Raw, and see how it compares to how I remember it. You know, does it hold up? Well, let's see. First, a few observations as I went back and watched this show. Things that stuck out to me. First of all, so much more star power back then than you would find today. I mean, even some of the mid-card guys were over like the main eventers were. The New Age Outlaws, you know, all the DX guys, X-Pac, the freaking Godfather, for crying out loud. All these guys. Plus, you add in the main event talent they had back then, Austin, McMahon. I would count McMahon because that was at the height of the Austin-McMahon feud. Undertaker, Kane, Triple H, who wasn't quite at the main event level yet, but was pretty close. The Rock, if I didn't mention him, Mankind. I know I'm missing one or two people, but there were just so many. There were so many big stars at that time. The star power was just, it can't even compare to today. It really can't. I mean, the level of star power then to now is kind of depressing, quite frankly. Also, 2 hours, much easier to sit through than 3 hours. Big stars or no big stars. It helps that the shows were much hotter back then when wrestling was hot and they had all those guys, but even if they weren't hot, 3 hours, it's just too much. Not for a pay-per-view. For a pay-per-view, 3 hours is perfect, but for a show with commercials and skits and that sort of thing, you know, at least today during the commercial breaks, if you ever go to a Raw taping or a SmackDown taping, they air videos on the TitanTron. Some of it's just ads to plug their crap, but that's fine. Back then, they didn't do anything. The arena just went dark until they came, well, not fully dark, but it was just stagnant until they came back on the air. It was boring. And finally, signs. Lots and lots of signs. A sea of signs. Signs everywhere. Way more than you'll find today. Which is funny to me because, again, WWE loves talking about freedom of speech and all that stuff. But what do you hear about? You always hear about signs being taken away from people. And that's part of the reason why there aren't as many now. You have more kids, but you probably have a lot of people who know that their signs are going to get taken away. They got tired of it, so they don't even make them anymore. You know, and so you see signs, and some of them are kind of creative, but you don't see as many as you did back then. I mean, I would imagine that if I were in the crowd, like not in the first few rows, I would be the most like pissed off person in the world because all you ever saw were people holding up their signs. How the people behind them could see, I don't know. They probably couldn't. Probably started a lot of fights back then. But yeah, it was just like a sea of signs. So the show starts, and the first thing that happened on the show, and I remember this like it was yesterday, Shawn Michaels makes his grand return. This was Shawn Michaels' first appearance on Raw, I think on TV at all, since WrestleMania 14. He had been gone for many months. He had the bad back. He didn't have back surgery yet. He had the surgery, I think, the year after. Maybe he was trying to just rest it and rehab it. He looked good. He came out. He was dancing around and posing, and you know, he didn't look like a crippled guy. People went crazy for him. So he came out right at the start of the show. Didn't cut a promo or anything. He just came out to head over to the announce table where he was going to be the guest commentator with Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler for the remainder of the show. And it's funny because one of the first questions that Jim Ross asks him is, when are you coming back? You know, when are you going to be back in the ring? And Shawn gives the most evasive answer. You know, he was like, well, you know, that's not up to me. It's up to the man upstairs. But that's neither here nor there. Let's talk about the action tonight. It was like, it was something to that effect. Because even he didn't know. He didn't know. He probably didn't even think he was coming back. First match was Undertaker against Vader. And I have to talk about the entrances here. Because the Undertaker, now the Undertaker has been burned or nearly burned many times in his WWE career. If you listen to one of the recent Talk is Jericho podcasts when they had Paul Heyman and Edge on, I think it was during that show, Jericho told the story about when Undertaker once got burned. I think it was at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. He was walking down the aisle and flames just shot up right on him. And he moved to one side. More flames came up. He tried to move to the other side. More flames came up. And it burned him. You know, he had to go into one of the pods, and he was pouring water all over himself and went backstage after the show, and he was cool as a cucumber and told Vince McMahon in no uncertain terms that if I find that pyro guy, he's a dead man. And that was his way of saying, you better fire him, and that's what they did. They fired the pyro guy. But the first time that Undertaker nearly got his face burned off was on the show. He came down to the ring, and he did the deal where he walks up the steps, so now he's outside the ring on the apron in the corner by the post. And the lights are still down. He's going to raise his arms up in the air, and the lights are going to come on. Well, the lights came on, but what happened is fire shot out of that post in that corner. And obviously he was not expecting it. And he quickly, you know, turned his head, and on commentary they cut back to like Shawn Michaels, and Shawn has this look of terror on his face like, uh-oh, is he okay? And then they just kind of move on from there. And I don't think it actually touched him. I imagine that it came close, and I'm sure he wasn't very happy about that, but that was a scary moment. So Vader came out. Vader was near the end of his rope in WWE at this point. I don't know exactly when his last match was. It had to have been around this time. It was probably late summer or fall of 98 when he left the company and went back to Japan. So this may have been, if not his last, one of his big TV matches, his last big TV matches. This was a pay-per-view caliber main event only like a year and a half earlier, and here they are opening the show. That's how far down Vader's stock had fallen at that point. And so Undertaker beat him with the tombstone. Mankind comes out, goes to hit Undertaker with the chair after the match, but Kane stops him. And what they were doing here was they were teasing around this time a potential alliance between Undertaker and Kane, who had been feuding for months. And this was the beginning of an Undertaker heel turn. By the time SummerSlam rolled around, it was Undertaker and Austin. Undertaker was maybe not 100% heel. Maybe people just didn't figure it out yet, but he was mostly heel by that point. So they were teasing the fact that, oh, you know, Kane just saved the Undertaker, or did he? And they wanted to kind of keep that mystery going. And they were building to a match at the pay-per-view that month. It was going to be Austin and Undertaker against Kane and Mankind at Fully Loaded. So that was their way of promoting the match. You know, whose side is he on? Is Undertaker with his brother? Or is he going to have Austin's back at the pay-per-view? We had a shot of Edge in the crowd. This was back when Edge was doing his emo gimmick where he would just kind of hang out as this lost soul in the crowd wearing the trench coat and the sunglasses. We had Bart Gunn and Bob Holly in a Brawl for All match. Danny Hodge was out there as a judge. Bob and Bart were tag team partners at the time. They had formed this team called the New Midnight Express. I think Jim Cornette might have been managing them. They were Bombastic Bob and Bodacious Bart. Really. Those were their names. I can't imagine why the act never got over. But they were also two tough guys. Bob Holly's a tough guy. Bart Gunn, as we would find out since he would go on to win the whole thing, he was very tough. And you would think it would make for a really exciting back-and-forth match. This was, I don't want to call it a slaughter, but it was very one-sided. The way Brawl for All would work, it was a legitimate contest. They would put boxing gloves on you, and you would go, and you would get a certain number of points for punches landed. You would get points for takedowns, stuff like that. Bart ended up winning 15-0. I think it went to a decision. He won 15-0, so a clean sweep. Holly ended up pie-facing him after the fight, so poor sportsmanship on his part. We had highlights of DX impersonating the Nation, which I think occurred on the Raw right before this show. One of the all-time great segments in Raw history. Jason Sensation stole the show with his impression of Owen Hart. Jason Sensation was a fan. He might have done some stuff for indie promotions beforehand, but he was a fan who did great realistic impressions of the wrestlers, and somebody must have found out about him, and he got his big break by being brought in for that DX skit where they impersonated the Nation. So he was back on this show this week at the commentary booth. He came by, sat next to Jerry Lawler, and Lawler was having fun with it. Lawler was like tickled to death by all of these impressions that he was doing. He was having him, do an impression of Shawn Michaels, do an impression of Bret Hart and Undertaker and Steve Austin and all these different people. But Lawler wanted him to do a whole bunch of Owen Hart impressions because the Owen Hart impressions the week before were so awesome. So he's like, sure. And he's impersonating Owen Hart and making fun of him. Owen does not appreciate this at all. Owen was part of the Nation at the time. They were doing a group promo backstage. And all of a sudden you see Owen walk out of camera shot because he's had enough. He has seen enough. And he attacks poor Jason Sensation.
Give me some more Owen Hart.
Well, you know, I wake up in the morning and I love the smell of coffee all the way in Brazil. Woo!
Hey, come on, Owen!
Oh,
come on! Owen, come on! Hey, wait a minute!
Come on!
He's a kid, Owen! He's a kid! Come on! Come on! That's totally uncalled for! Now, come on! The sharpshooter! Owen Hart got the sharpshooter on this kid!
Jim Ross was awesome. Rock and Owen Hart against Triple H and X-Pac. X-Pac got the win for his team, pinning Rock with his facebuster move. Steve Blackman beat Marvelous Mark Merrill with Sable on commentary. And Blackman won with a bicycle kick. I guess that would be a brogue kick by today's standards. Sable stopped Jacqueline, who had been managing Merrill at the time, from interfering. And so Merrill's losing streak continues. And the thing about Mark Merrill was, it was almost like two different careers that he had in WWE, because when he first came over, he was a babyface. He had Sable in his corner, who was his real-life wife at the time. And he got over as a high flyer. He would do moonsaults off the ropes. He did the 450 splash. He was a very flashy kind of guy. And then he hurt his knee, and he needed reconstructive surgery on his knee, which ended up killing his career. Because it not only forced him to change his style to a less flashy, more ground-based style when he got back, it allowed his wife to kind of overshadow him and become a bigger star than he was. And they turned it into a storyline when he came back. But when that storyline was done, there was nothing else for Mero to do. He just wasn't. I mean, compared to the kind of matches he was having before, Mero was boring. You know, he had the Golden Gloves boxing background, so he incorporated that into his character, and he would use his fists. And people didn't want to see that. They wanted to see the old Mark Merrow, the wild man, Johnny B. Badd. He couldn't be that anymore because he was never really the same after the knee surgery, the knee injury. So in a lot of ways, it was the beginning of the end of his career. And then eventually what happened is he was booked in a match with Gilbert, Dwayne Gill, where I think he made the promise that this guy's a joke. If I lose, you know what? I'm done. My career is over. Well, he lost, and I think he stuck to his guns. That was it. He was done with WWE. I don't know that he ever wrestled again after that, and that was the end of his career. So his career went out on a bit of a down note. Sable's career kept going up, 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 and of course now, you know, they would split eventually, and now she's Mrs. Brock Lesnar. So it's funny how those things work. Kane and Mankind beat the New Age Outlaws to win the tag team titles. JR said the Outlaws have been champions since last November after beating LOD, so I guess they didn't count the Cactus Jack Terry Funk win at WrestleMania 14, because they did beat the Outlaws. Undertaker was at ringside for the match, never got involved, which built further intrigue about whether or not he's actually aligned with his brother Kane. The Nation came out, created a diversion by brawling down the aisle to ringside with DX. That allowed D'Lo Brown to come out of the crowd and deliver a frog splash to Road Dogg, chest protector and all. And the reason that D'Lo was wearing a chest protector back then was he had a match on Raw with Dan the Beast Severn, who is a legitimate tough guy, great wrestler, former UFC champion. And so they brought Severn in, I guess off the success, somewhat success, of Ken Shamrock's run in WWE. And I remember the match he had with D'Lo where he stretched him. He put him in the submission hold where he just stretched the shit out of him. And after that, D'Lo would show up wearing a chest protector. But it got comical. It was kind of like Ace Cowboy Bob Orton back in the day when he hurt his arm, supposedly, and he had the cast, but then the cast never went away. It's like the arm never healed. So the cast became part of his gimmick. That's what happened with D'Lo. Although I think this was only about a month after the Severn match, so the chest protector was still relatively new, but he would wear it for a long time after that. Anyway, he gave Road Dogg a splash, and that's what led to the finish of the match. Taka Michinoku and Too Much, later known as Too Cool, Grandmaster and Scotty Too Hotty, who were heels still at the time. They were also very reluctant partners. They did not want a team with Taka Michinoku, but they beat, they lost to Kayentai, managed by Yamaguchi-san. Lots of international flavor here. Shawn Michaels said that you might call this WWE's version of the World Cup. So, a timely reference there. We had a shoving match after the match between Taka and Scott Taylor. Actually, that was the end of the match. It resulted in Taylor getting beaten by Dick Togo with a senton. So it led to the finish. Val Venus came out after the match to apologize to Yamaguchi-san by saying he now realizes that no man should ever mess around with another man's wife, which is exactly what Val was doing back then. He was fucking around with Yamaguchi-san's very young-looking wife. Certainly, he was many years older than her. And he then showed a censored video of Yamaguchi-san's wife performing oral sex on him back at the hotel. And Yamaguchi freaked out, and Val ended by telling him when they get a taste of the big Valboski, they never, ever come back. And this was the setup to I choppy choppy your pee-pee. And only Attitude Era fans will know what I mean when I say that, but I believe that's what followed, was Yamaguchi-san's revenge. Vince McMahon came out, he called out The Undertaker, wanted to know if he's in cahoots with Kane. Undertaker tells him to go to hell. Not a very nice thing to say to your boss. I would not advise that anybody listening to this do that. Out comes Stone Cold, who wants to know the same thing. Are they going to be partners at the pay-per-view, or is it going to be a three-on-one match? What are we doing here? Undertaker tells him to go to hell. Out comes DX and Triple H. Triple H tells Vince McMahon he wants the Outlaws to get their rematch tonight for the tag team titles against Kane and Mankind with three referees, one inside and two enforcers on the outside. That being Steve Austin and The Undertaker. That way, he'll find out if Undertaker is actually helping Kane or not. And Vince likes that plan, he makes the match. We again see Edge brooding in the crowd. He's not doing anything. He's just kind of hanging out there. I hope he bought a ticket, because otherwise he's trespassing. Jim Ross was promoting the upcoming UFC pay-per-view on commentary. Frank Shamrock against Jeremy Horn for the main event, if any of you are interested in knowing. That was weird. We had another Brawl for All match. Dan Severn, who I just mentioned, against The Godfather. Severn wins on takedowns. A very boring Brawl for All match, as those go. And finally, the main event, New Age Outlaws against Kane and Mankind, rematch for the Tag Team Championship. Austin brought his cooler down to the ring with him. You'll never see John Cena do that. Referee got crushed in the corner, took a bump. Outlaws got Kane down for the pin. Steve Austin slides in to count the fall. Undertaker pulls him out. And the announcers freak out. That must mean that Undertaker and Kane are in cahoots. Kane chokeslams Road Dogg, goes for the pin. Undertaker slides in. He gets pulled out, or I think Austin somehow broke up the fall. Kane attacks Austin. Undertaker attacks Mankind. DX runs down. This huge brawl breaks out. It's just pandemonium. No result here to this match. No contest. Austin starts stunning people. Undertaker's chokeslamming people. Jim Ross is freaking out on headset. The fans are going crazy. This ending was the Attitude Era in a nutshell. If you didn't live through it, you missed out. Because it's not the same when you go back and watch it. I had fun watching this, actually. This was one of the probably the more enjoyable episodes from that time period. Because people romanticize a lot about the Attitude Era. There was a lot of shit that was put out on TV back then. But I thought this episode perfectly encompassed what that era was all about. You know, all the star power that they had. Austin is the main event guy. Undertaker is, you know, in the main event position. Kane, Mankind. Rock was still coming into his own as part of the Nation. He wasn't quite at that main event level yet, nor was Triple H, but they were both on the cusp. I think it was the month after they had their big ladder match at SummerSlam that really sent both, more so Rock. Rock lost that match, but it was after that that he became this big babyface, the number two babyface in the company, and then they did the big swerve at Survivor Series when he won the championship for the first time. So you could see the evolution of these guys and the mid-card characters like Val Venus, and guys like The Godfather and X-Pac and stuff like that. So I thought this episode held up pretty well, all things considered. I don't know that I would feel the same way if I was sitting here watching all these week after week after week, like I did back in the day. And the other big difference, I think, between then and now is if you're a big fan of wrestling, like in-ring wrestling, you didn't get a whole lot of that back then. You know, the main events would deliver, although those were more brawls. They weren't like technical wrestling masterpieces or anything like that. You didn't have guys like Punk and Brian doing their thing in the ring. If you're more of an in-ring guy, you probably will not like these shows. The Attitude Era probably is not for you. The current era, or maybe even the Ruthless Aggression era, when they had the SmackDown 6 stuff going on, the Guerreros and Benoit and Angle. I think Brock might have been part of that. Edge and Ray. I guess Brock maybe wasn't part of the SmackDown 6 technically, but Brock had a lot of great matches on SmackDown back during that 2002-2003 period. Even then, the wrestling was far better than you would find in the late 90s. But it wasn't about that. You know, it was all about fun, man. It was about big stars. It was about attitude and flipping people off and, you know, using foul language and women who were half naked and the characters. It was about the characters more than anything else. And it's just very different. It was a very different time in wrestling. It was that appeal that brought in a lot of that casual audience that disappeared 2-3 years later. You know, when the stars started to go away, guys got hurt, WCW went away, that didn't help, because competition always makes things better. There was no more WCW, some of those stars weren't there. Some of those stars at that point were stale. Some of those stars maybe turned heel when they shouldn't have, and that killed business also. A lot of different things happened. And then, you know, PG didn't come until 2008, but you could see even from like 01 to 07 before PG came, I mean, it was just this descent in popularity of the product. So it was fun. It was fun to go back and reflect on that 16 years later. Hopefully you enjoyed it. I would say go check it out on the network, but they don't have that Raw up on the network, so I guess you're shit out of luck unless you have a copy of the VHS and a working VCR. That's about the only way. You can keep emailing me questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address for that. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I'm also on Instagram, I believe The Salamonster, I believe, is my name on there. I'll be at the TNA tapings again at the beginning of August. That'll probably be the next time I put stuff up on that page, so I don't spoil things on Twitter for people. We're on Facebook. Profile page is The Salamonster with the extra E. You can send me a friend request there. We have a Facebook group, Salamonster Sounds Off. You have to apply for approval. I'm very selective these days in who I approve to keep out some of the trolls and undesirables. So if you have applied for membership and have not been approved, and it's been a while because I have about 300 people in queue who I'm skeptical of and I am not approving, at least not yet, you might want to send me a personal message just so I know who you are and that you are, in fact, a fan of the show, and then I can approve you. But that is the place to go for that. We have a YouTube channel as well. I have some free time this week, and I'm hoping in the next few days to get up a YouTube mailbag exclusive to the YouTube channel to try to catch up on all the questions you guys have been sending me. So you might want to subscribe and stay tuned there for that. Keep streaming the show on Stitcher Radio. Subscribe in iTunes. Leave some feedback. Leave a review for us in there because that's always helpful. Thanks again for sticking with me. 2.5 hours of audio this week. Whole lot more where that came from coming up. Next weekend we'll have Battleground predictions and a whole lot more. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you as always for the support, and we shall see you right back here again for a new podcast next weekend. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Salamonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Charlotte into the cover of Natalya! Charlotte's the NXT Women's Champion!
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because Grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
Salamonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007. On thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.